Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Like they're in my head. That gets me hot, man. You can bet Alice Cooper is smiling like a proud father over that song. It rates right up there with his classic about necrophilia, I Love the Dead. That's kind of disturbing. All right, kiddies, that's a wrap for this week. We want to thank Warner Brothers Records for that one. All other concert material was recorded by Westwood One Mogul, Biff Dawes Engineer, assisted by Doug Field, Phil Nebone, and Jay Resnick, the usual suspects. This particular program is written and reduced by Fred Lindgren, and a fine job he does at that. In-studio production by Stephen Cosio. Executive producer Norm, I'm loving the Colbster, Pattis. He's the pimp of the century. I'm Nick Carter. Peace out, my bitches.
101.1 WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Say you want a revolution. Well, you know. Now.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and hey, let's do this. Peter Werby here with you. Jalene Jordan off for the night. Those opening chords, many of you recognize, is that of Ron Ashton, the Stooges guitar. He and the Stooges found dead last week at 60 years old. Dedicate the show to him. Wonderful music the man made. And, somewhere down here. Yeah, he invents the template for punk rock guitar. This is Brian Cogan, a punk music historian at Molloy College at New York's Long Island University. Welcome to the broadcast. I've gotten so used to having Jalene here. All of a sudden, something seems kind of wrong. You know, where is she? What's that thing for My Fair Lady? I've grown accustomed to your face and all that. Well, so it's you and me, 313-298-WRIF, and I've never memorized the numbers. After all these years, Jalene always says them, 313-298-9743. She'll be back next week, no problem, just having the night off. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com is our, email, and you can... if you have something to say and you're bashful or the lines are not filled right now, please jump in there with some email. The shorter they are, because I can't edit them, right? If they're like some treatise, I can't deal with them. Well, this monstrous military invasion of Gaza continues by Israel and going into the heart of Gaza City. You may know from, because this is not information that you know, is unavailable. Gaza City, the Gaza Strip is one of the most densely populated areas in the world. And to be carrying out modern warfare, that was really designed, although this isn't entirely the case, but it was designed for field warfare with that kind of weaponry, with F-16s. All of this, by the way, everything that you see hitting Gaza is paid for by you and me. That's right. Those are American weapons, and you and I contributed billions and billions of dollars for all of this. Right now, according to Human Rights Watch, Israel's military has fired artillery shells with the incendiary agent white phosphorus into Gaza. And a doctor said the chemical was suspected in the case of 10 burn victims who had skin peeling off their faces and bodies. They're also using depleted uranium shells, which has led both to where they've been used previously in Iraq and elsewhere to increase cases of cancer. And this is always these incursions, like with a Western, essentially Western military power, they all become these little laboratories for seeing how the weapons work and the strategies. Now, I don't want to. We could actually, and in fact, oh yeah, here it is. The first or second line in a January 7th article, because sort of the ruling or the governing little rationale for the war, if you will, is that what would you do if somebody was bombing your country? Here Hamas sent rockets into Israel and Israel responded. Well, there is the thing, as we said last week, of proportionality. I mean, as it stands now, there are thousands of Palestinian casualties, overwhelmingly civilians. They're hiding among the civilians. Hey, they all live there. I mean, that's the problem for the Israelis, right? Militarily, they don't care. They're collateral damage. They're, you know, they text people. Imagine that. They talk about modernity. They text people. They drop leaflets, which isn't so modern, and make phone calls. And they say, "You got to get out of this neighborhood." So people go to the next neighborhood, and the people there were told, "You got to get out of your neighborhood too." So this is a war essentially against the civilian population. But what appears, particularly in the mainstream media, is that Israel is responding to these rockets that Hamas fired into their country. And absolutely unjustifiably. These are not accurate. A country that is occupied under international law has the right to attack soldiers. It does not have the right to indiscriminately attack civilians or just to launch missiles in the way that Hamas has been doing. But these really pale in terms of war crimes, in terms of what Israel is doing. But so this was immediate, right? One has to react, just like if somebody enters your home and they're armed, or someone comes into your house shooting, you have every right in the world to shoot back at them. There's no time for discussion. There's no time for legalities or what have you. Except, and here is an article in the New York Times, called "For Israel, 2006 Lessons, But Old Pitfalls." And they're talking about the invasion of Lebanon by Israel in 2006. So this time, Israeli military commanders are leading from the front, not trying to direct the infantry from television screens. And here is the key phrase. This time, the military has clear plans in stages drawn up with a year's preparation. This time, the Israeli military has clear plans in stages drawn up with a year's preparation. So they were planning this for a long, long time. Now, what is going on here? When you see these children, and certainly children that are around where these Hamas rockets fell, experience the same thing. These are a traumatized people. I mean, thousands and thousands of Palestinians have been killed by, tens of thousands of Palestinians have been killed over the last 40 years, driven from their homeland. I mean, that's why people are in Gaza. They weren't there. It's not their ancestral homeland. Their ancestral homeland is what is now Israel. They're driven from their land in 1948. So it's a concentration camp, essentially, of refugees who, over the years, transformed refugee camps into cities. And yet, surrounded by the Israelis as they are, that has a blockade, because the people of Gaza had the temerity to elect Hamas, democratically elect Hamas. The United States, the European Union, and Israel have decided unilaterally that it's okay to cut off the fundamentals of what every civilized nation expects. That is, food, medicine, energy, and what have you. But how about this for a counter, narrative? Remember we were talking about that phrase narrative? Because if you ask many Israelis, although there are many that are in opposition to this war as well, or from what you see at least portrayed in the media, the Detroit Jewish community, there's one narrative there. They see, again, Jews are at risk. The nation, which is protecting them, responded. If you are on the other side, if you are of Arabic Middle Eastern ancestry, this is just a long history of a white settler colonial nation launching punitive actions against an Arab population, and almost close to, given the weaponry that each side has, the Arab population, the Palestinians in this case, are virtually defenseless. Although I guess they're putting up quite a defense as things go on. But as we know, the casualties, it's about 1,000 Palestinians dead, 14 Israelis, 14 to 1,000, and a good number of those Israelis were victims of friendly fire. But here's another narrative, and I've heard a little of this. It was launched now. It was launched now because of Israeli elections, and each side wanting involved in the elections, the Israelis, wanted to show that they were tough, that they were going to respond. They weren't going to negotiate. They weren't going to say, hey, look, we realize we broke the ceasefire any number of times. But what one could say... And this goes to the popular, what would you call it, the image, the crazy Arab. In fact, you got to go to the Arab American Museum in Dearborn, right on Michigan at Schaefer. And they have a whole area where it's Arab stereotypes. They're crazy, right? So, and you would think, why in the world would they do this? Why would Hamas fling a couple of rockets that are, although they hurt some people, was essentially ineffective in creating great harm or great damage. The people that got hurt, they certainly think it was great damage, but it was, compared to what's going on now, relatively minor. Now, why would they do that? Well, they're crazy. They hate Israel. They hate Jews. You know, they want to drive the Israelis into the sea. Well, that doesn't seem real possible, particularly in the short run. And since each side has spies, why would they take that upon themselves to do that when they must have known that Israel would respond? Hamas must have known Israel would respond. Well, are they suicidal? Have they been driven so crazy, like the American Indians who were also driven from their land? So they began in the late 1890s, mid-1890s, began these ghost dances where they thought they were impervious to bullets, that they were so destroyed, their cultures had been so destroyed by our European invasion, as opposed to the European invasion of Palestine, that they just lost any sense of reality, and they thought, whatever we can do, even pinpricks are better than nothing. How about this? They, in fact, knew Israel was going to respond. Maybe not with this intensity. In fact, it's a little hard for me to believe, although I don't know, that they would respond with a military incursion or bombings or something that would respond to the Hamas rockets. Well, why would they do this? Why would they do this? Why would they set themselves up? Well, how about this? How about it's about elections again? Hamas popularity in Gaza was beginning to drop, and there's going to be an election in the West Bank. There's going to be an election in the West Bank. And the official Palestine Liberation Group that with Abbas as the president is losing popularity rapidly. And this could lead to a victory of Hamas, a democratic victory of Hamas, the Palestine Authority, is what Abbas is the head of. A Hamas victory, not in this little Gaza Strip, but in all of the West Bank. All of the West Bank. So this was a gamble that Hamas would take in order to gain control of the West Bank. That, in fact, Gaza becomes collateral damage, even to them. These are cynical politicians. Remember, these are right-wing fundamentalists. These are the kind of things that other right-wing fundamentalists do around war issues, like George Bush in Iraq. But how about this, for even more of a conspiratorial view? Israel knew this because long-range strategic planning for Israel does not involve a second state in that area. It does not involve a Palestinian state. There is never going to be a two-state solution as long as Israel has anything to say of it. They're not even going to have this little controlled sector with its Bantustans like they had in South Africa, where essentially the Palestinians control nothing but just have the worst land that's left over that settlers haven't gobbled up. So at the most, are you following all this? Hamas knows that Israel is going to respond, but it's okay because this is going to raise the popularity of Hamas and allow them to displace the Palestine Authority in the West Bank. But this is okay with Israel because that means that they have a more implacable, intransient enemy in the West Bank. That would mean there's another reason not to allow an emergence of a Palestinian state. It's all very horrible. And, of course, who is suffering? 98% of the people suffering are the Palestinians. 2% are the Israelis that have suffered these unjustifiable rockets from Hamas. I don't know what to say. The weapons that are being used, the fact that you and I are paying for them, it's terrible. All right, Laura Bush is showing off the new China. Did you see that? Almost $500,000 price tag. First Lady Laura Bush showed off new gold-rimmed set of official George W. Bush state china on Wednesday, less than 2 weeks to use it before the family packs up for Texas. So we're going to have this reminder of this criminal regime, the Bush crime family, in its final act. $500,000 for settings for 320. Now, don't get too upset. It's not paid for by you and me. It's just not a last final act of this racket, this 100% racket that tried to pose itself as a government. But what struck me about it, let's see, the $493,000 set was inspired by a few pieces of green basket weave patterned French china in the White House collection, believed to have come from James and Dolly Madison. Do they know that there is a massive depression going on all around the world and in this country and in our state here of Michigan? How unseemly this is that these people put up $500,000 for a bunch of china. Former First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton also unveiled official china shortly before leaving the White House. That set, and a famously expensive one commissioned by Nancy Reagan, are the plates now used for large events, but the Bush china has more place settings, 320, than either of those. Now, why do our presidents live like the kings and queens of old? Isn't this supposed to be a popular democracy? But it really is an oligarchy, right? A plutocracy. The rule of a few, the rule of the rich. And they make no bones about it. They live like the class they represent. They essentially, all policies represent this upper 1 or 2%. The ruling class, the economic elite, the people that have screwed up everything and made so many lives so miserable, have ruined the chances of so many families, have brought such suffering and deprivation to so many people. And the wife of the main representative that's still going to be in there for about another 9 days shows off her new china, $493,000. Makes me sick. How about you? Well, Laura is going to publish a memoir. What do you think about that? Is she going to tell all? They refer to her as a reserved and enigmatic public figure. But how much she will disclose remains a mystery. I doubt if she's going to talk about how she was known as Dimebag Laura back in college, right? You know, Dimebag is, that's marijuana. Or the circumstances under which her boyfriend was killed in a traffic accident that she was involved in. I don't know. 313-298-WRIF. Let me see if there's anything else here. Yeah, let's just do... And there's some open lines, too. But let's do a little bit of the economy. After weak holiday sales, retailers prepare for even worse. On Thursday, many chains reported the worst holiday shopping season in decades, and the stores are entering the new year so weakened that some might not survive. Levin Macy's just closed, by the way. In fact, let me see. I'll have to go to my, I don't know why all of a sudden I get his email every day. Clint from Dearborn sends in every day. Today's layoffs, closings, and bankruptcies. Not pretty, is it? But a wave of corporate failures has already taken out stores like Sharper Image. I didn't know that. Linen and Things is expected to grow substantially worse in coming months, sending some of the well-known names of American retailing into bankruptcy. So this is the spiral downwards. This is what these financial geniuses have created. What did you do wrong? What did I do wrong? Did you screw up at all? Did you do something, or you and I collectively, as consumers and workers, men and women that get paychecks, that try to put a little away for our retirement or are way behind on our credit card because we just, you know, the value of the dollar has gone down over the years and there's more and more inclination to buy more and more in order to keep this economy going. In fact, that's what we have to do, right? We have to be these incessant consumers. There's no such thing as a stasis of a calm point where we can say, okay, everything is in balance. You know that whole Eastern concept of everything in balance? This is never in balance. It's, you know, yin and yang. You've seen that, I don't know, I'm drawing it with my finger in the air. That black and white symbol with kind of an S through the middle, one side black, one side white, and a black dot in the white side and a white dot in the black side. That perfect harmony, perfect balance. It's, and yang is assertive, aggressive, male. Well, this, capitalism is this yang system. It's always got to be, you know, launching aggressively forward. And you and I have to follow along. We have to consume more and more, or we're not good Americans. Because I'll tell you, if it was left to me as a consumer, we probably would have had a depression, I don't know, 10 years ago. I don't consume that much. Yeah. There's nothing out there. These trinkets and clothing and watches and, I don't know, all this electronic gear and all, I mean, it doesn't hold much of an allure for me. And I'm not, you know, I'm not criticizing you if it does, if you'd find it alluring. But if everyone consumed at the level that I do, the economy would have been screwed a long, long time ago. Industry sales fell 2.2%. That's interesting. That was enough to send it downward. The weak economy, rising unemployment, winter storms, and a dearth of compelling fashions. Oh, there wasn't any compelling fashions, man. There's never any compelling fashions for me. Now they're worried that the recession is going to make us even more overweight. Because what happens is that the specter of recession pounds is a concern where these health professionals point to numerous studies linking obesity and unhealthy eating habits to low income. One of the things that happens is that people don't buy as much fresh fish or fruit or vegetables or even whole grains and instead get those cheaper options that are high in sugar and saturated fat. Now, here's a guy, Adam Drewnowski. He's the director of the Nutrition Sciences Program at the University of Washington in Seattle. He says things are going to get worse. Obesity is a toxic result of a failing economic environment. Now, you know, all these richies, they're thin, they're lean. You know, they go to their clubs, they have personal trainers. This doesn't happen to them. I mean, some of them are beginning to hurt a little. I read about this. A couple guys committed suicide. Wrong ones, the wrong ones, that's for sure. But they stay slim because, you know, they want to look good. In fact, I was just looking in the New York Times today, and they still had these, what they call them, hobo bags. These are for women, $2,000. Hobo. You know, hobo like a bum, a tramp. Eat the rich, is what I say. They've eaten us. There's not even much there to eat anymore. They've ruined it all. But it says 9 of the 10 states with the highest rates of new cases of diabetes were in the South, in a region with huge pockets of poverty and glaring income disparities. So getting sick and having ill health is not just, you know, bad, getting some bad cards in your hand. You can try, please do, eat a good diet. It's one way to protect ourselves because we haven't figured out how to really protect ourselves. When I say eat the rich, we haven't figured out how to do it. I mean, they've screwed everything up badly, and we're just counting on them now to put it right. We're hoping Barack Obama can put it all together. And, you know, it's not clear. In fact, one of the things that I thought was really funny, that the Republicans, I don't know, this was a week ago or so, they have ripped Bush a new one, and they're calling Bush a socialist. Solomon Yu, an Oregon member and co-sponsor of a resolution. That was a Freudian sleep, right? Or slip? For the Republican National Committee. It says that, they accuse Bush and congressional Republican leaders of embracing socialism, underscoring the deep dissension within the party at the end of Bush's administration. And it can't end too soon. It doesn't matter now. He's gone for all practical purposes. And now the only debate is whether the new government should go after him for his high crimes and misdemeanors that are actually felonious, that violated the Constitution, that violated the statutes, federal statutes, and that violated international law. I mean, Bush and Cheney now are confessing to approving torture. They have admitted to almost all their crimes with pride because they know, even though their approval rating's around 20%, that nothing's going to happen to them. Yeah, they're not suffering anything. You know, it just occurs to me. Well, never mind. This was a technical thing. This is what I need Jolene here for, who's off for the night. And so where's all this money going to come from? China, according to the New York Times on January 8th, has bought more than $1 trillion of American debt. You understand this? We, Americans, you and me, and our kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, owe the Chinese government, these are the commies, right? They're still the commies. We owe the commies $1 trillion, folks. But the global downturn has intensified, and Beijing is starting to keep more of its money at home, a move that could have painful effects for American borrowers. That's us, the government. The declining Chinese appetite for United States debt. How did we ever get into that part, that point to begin with, that a foreign country can hold our debt? Remember, 2000, there was a surplus of the budget. George W. Bush, the wrecker, not the decider, but the wrecker, has sent us down the drain, right? Well, it's, no one looks at what is really the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and that's the military budget, and that is these continuing wars. And as long as those continue, we're never going to make any headway whatsoever. So we've got to begin to immediately re-divert the hundreds of billions of dollars that are going for these useless wars that we're getting ripped off big time by these contractors, by the corruption of Iraq, by the corruption of the Afghan government, and re-divert that into our needs. Because, you know, where did all this money come from? Where did these hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars come from that have been wasted in Iraq? And it hasn't just gone up into the air. It hasn't evaporated. It has gone into the pockets of the people who are, guess what? They are, they are taking it from us. Now, I got to do a little something here, and then we will be right back. Let me see if I can make this happen. Ah, I can't do it. Button might hit something right in the middle. Where are you now that I need you? But anyways, I need you folks, too, as well. I'm Peter Werby. This is Night Call, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743.
If you're like most Michigan families.
$9 million.
All of you who have stuck with me.
Divided by 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the RIM. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And
I'm sorry.
We'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more detail. 101 WRIF.
My phone blowing up.
Do you know the fastest way to learn a new language?
Memorization?
We always did translation.
Is it drills?
The world's fastest, easiest way to learn a new language is Rosetta Stone software. It doesn't waste your time with tedious translation, useless memorization, or boring drills. Instead, it teaches you a new language the same way you learned your first language. And right now, you can experience it for yourself because Rosetta Stone is offering a free demo CD-ROM. Check out the easiest, fastest way to learn the language of your choice. For the free CD-ROM, call 1-800-441-6151. Discover what U.S. diplomats, NASA, and over 10,000 schools already know, that this is the world's fastest, easiest way to learn a language guaranteed. Choose from 31 languages and request your free CD-ROM today. You'll be amazed at what you learn. Just call 1-800-441-6151. Request your free CD-ROM from Rosetta Stone by calling 1-800-441-6151. That's 1-800-441-6151.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. People who are sick and tired of wasting money on acne products that just don't work. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. Find out how to get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling 1-800-335-4191. Our combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine and soothing spa-quality botanicals to create a powerful acne-fighting system. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put us to the test and we'll prove it. Get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now toll-free 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Are you having trouble paying your credit card bills? You didn't expect to get so deep in debt, but now you need a way out, a way to relieve the anxiety, a way to avoid disaster. If you have over $12,000 in credit card debt, call Debt Settlement USA at 1-877-560-8877. Debt Settlement USA has a proven debt reduction program that can cut the amount you owe and get you out of debt faster than you could on your own. They've saved millions of dollars for their clients, and they can help you get back in control again too. If your resolution is to get out of debt, call Debt Settlement USA for a free consultation. 1-877-560-8877. Your call is confidential and there's no obligation. If you have over $12,000 in credit card bills, they can cut the amount you owe and help get you out of debt. Call Debt Settlement USA right now. 1-877-560-8877. That's 1-877-560-8877.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, 313-298-WRIF. Robert from Port Huron writes to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Peter and Jalene, well, Jalene is off tonight. She'll be back next week. Recently, I've engaged in a lively debate on the website of my hometown's local newspaper, which is the Times-Herald, on how George W. Bush lies have led to the needless death of over 4,000 Americans in Iraq. However, the supporters of Bushco cannot resort to anything but name-calling and personal attacks. Well, I don't know, James. Robert, rather. I don't know. James is middle name. Robert, I don't know. They're the 20%, you know, the 80% of Americans. You've won the argument. I don't know if it's necessary to, you know, to engage these guys. I mean, someone would say, what would I say to these people? I think what I would say is, see you later. All right, let's see. Here is Wendy Thompson. Wendy, thanks for joining me on Night Call. You're on the air. I don't think I did that right. Huh, there we go. Wendy, hi, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Yes, go ahead. You were going to tell us about a demonstration today that happened down at the auto show.
Yes, there were 150 of us, auto workers and our supporters in the community and our family members. And basically, we wanted to express our anger with the restrictions on the loan money that were put on by George Bush right before he goes out of office.
Uh-huh.
You know, basically he said that union workers have to go down to non-union wages, benefits, and working conditions. Then he takes the health care for retirees, which is only 50% funded, and saying that 50% of that must be GM stock. Then further, he said that not only must the job bank be eliminated, but also the subfund and health care payments, which are very important for people when they're on layoff. And we have a lot of auto workers on layoff right
now.
And
these are benefits that have been fought for 75 years and won.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it essentially is an attempt to attack unions and eliminate unions. That's what he's saying.
Well, if union wages are brought down to non-union auto wages, they're all going to fall. The only reason that the non-union automakers, the foreign car plants in this country, are paying what they do is because they have to compete with union wages in order to keep the union out. So everybody will be making $8 an hour.
That's right, Peter. And so what we have done is we have a website up called autoworkercaravan.org, because we're the same group that went down to Washington to attempt to get the loans in the first place to help that process and present a rank-and-file point of view. We have written an open letter to Southern workers talking about how we have the same people are attacking us all as working people, and how we have to join together, because we would like to convince them to come up to where we're at so we don't have to go down to where they're at. And they can do that by joining in the union movement.
Well, that's great. And say the website slowly.
Autoworkercaravan.org.
Autoworkercaravan.org.
Yes, you can go to the letter, read it. If you agree, you can sign it.
Well, great. Well, thanks for it. And what was the response of people going to the auto show? People expected just to see electric cars or whatever, and there's 150 auto workers and supporters. Did you get a good reception?
Yes, we did. It was a press day, and so we had quite a large number of reporters come over and talk to us, and they seemed very sympathetic with our point of view. You know, when it comes to the question of health care, what we were saying is that we believe everybody should have health care, and we pointed to John Conyers' bill to extend Medicare to everyone, bill number 676.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that they could see that we're not just there for ourselves. We want to extend what we've got to everybody. And then also we were talking about what do you do with all these auto plants that are being closed because supposedly market share has got down. They aren't selling the product. What we were suggesting is just like in World War II when they converted the plants to make products for the war effort, why don't they convert them now to other products that are needed, like mass transit or light rail or like green energy? What about making wind turbines? We feel that this would be, help the economy, and it would also help the health of the industry to keep more people working.
Well, those are good ideas, and the fact that people have grouped together to put forth those ideas is important, because if we're all just out there as these isolated, atomized individuals, we'll never get anywhere. Well, thank you so much, Wendy, for giving us that report.
And thank you.
All right, and you have a good evening. So that's autoworkercaravan.org. WRIF, here is Tony and Rose. Where be your...
Hi, I'm calling about the protest at 9 and Woodward. They changed the time at 4:15 to 5:15 now.
Uh-huh.
And they're still out there protesting for anybody that's interested.
People are still protesting because there's a war in Iraq. You know, every once in a while...
They changed the time, 4:15 to 5:15.
Okay. People just don't even...
...support you on... I got the flyer from you about in the military, nobody showed up, so they might have canceled it, or I might have got the wrong area. I don't know.
Well, there was a demonstration in black on Saturday at Military Michigan, indeed.
I guess I was on the wrong military then.
Well,
nobody there.
That could be. I'm sorry that happened.
I'm a member of SEIU Local 1 with the Janitors Union anyway.
Okay. You know what you can do? If you go to my website, usually, do you have access to a computer?
No.
All right. Well, that makes it a little more difficult, but I'm trying to think. If you send, what could you do?
Is there two militaries on Michigan?
I don't think so.
I was waiting over there, and I didn't see nobody over there.
What time?
I waited over there till 12 noon, and I didn't see nobody there.
It started at noon.
I didn't see nobody there. I was there early.
Huh. Don't know what to say. I'm sorry that that happened, Tony.
Okay.
All right. All right, so, yeah, people are still having these vigils around town because American soldiers are still dying. They're dying. Five or six American soldiers died in Afghanistan over the weekend. And you all knew about that, right, because it was this big headline. Oh, no, you didn't? Well, can you imagine the impact that it had on those families? They knew about it. All right, I'm having a little bit of a technical problem here, so I'm just going to go through these. I don't have the name. I don't have your name or city, so I'm going to just say hello and ask you who you are. Hi, you're on the air. It's Peter on WRIF. Thanks for joining me. Who's this?
Yeah, it's Ron, Detroit.
Hi.
Yeah, well, regarding the comments about what the, you know, the murderous campaign there, I'd call it an extermination campaign that the Israelis are carrying out. I'd like to point out that they're also using dime weapons, which are dense inert metal explosives, which uses tungsten. Tungsten is a neurotoxin. It contaminates the land for a long time, and it also causes cancer. And there are more severed body parts coming off as a result of the use of this than doctors have ever seen. Now, Peter, I'm going to ask you, and if Julene, you can certainly tell her as well, and even though she's not there on the program, why not be the first, perhaps on talk radio, to join Naomi Klein in demanding a tough sanctions regime against Israel, instead of wringing their hands and merely documenting like voyeurs and spectators the murderous behavior of the Israelis, it's time to give Palestinians the same assistance that we gave South Africans of the apartheid regime. And I remind you that black South Africans who have visited the Palestinian ghettos have repeatedly observed that the conditions that they have seen there far exceeds the horrible conditions that existed in the apartheid regime. So therefore, how can a human rights activist give one group assistance and deny another? I mean, it sounds like...
it's also going to be introduced into the Senate, and I'll bet you that passes 100-0.
Peter, we can do our own action. We can boycott. Are you there?
I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay. We can boycott Israeli goods. We can do very similar things to what the Turkish unprecedented event in sports. The Israeli basketball team was in Turkey, and all of a sudden, the Turkish fans started chanting some kind of slogan about the Palestinians in Israel, raised fists, and they started moving, I guess, down towards the floor. The Israeli basketball team evacuated the floor, and that was the end of that game. Unprecedented, apparently, in sports, but it's a good first start, and it should be happening here as well. There are things we can do beyond that. We can certainly start seriously talking about simply, if we had a rotten Congress that is doing bad things to labor. I mean, all of the things that are wrong in this country are going on because Americans will not get a spine and take the action that is necessary, and that is consumer strikes, general strikes, and tax payment revolts. The economy is so low now that it can be argued that actually a small number of dedicated consumer strikers could actually bring this economy to its knees and force Congress to do our will, and it is about time we get a spine and stop acting like rugs.
Yeah. Well, the economy may fall by its own weight, but whatever. I don't know that this particular tactic or that particular tactic is what we need. I mean, we haven't even figured out even what we as an American people want or need. And that's what's necessary. It's necessary to create an apparatus, a movement, if you will, that has general demands across the country and specific ones for each locale. And we have to see who's causing the problem, who's caused the problem. Well, we know that. There's nothing bad has happened to them. I mean, they're just waiting to kind of get back, to what they consider normal. In the meantime, the real casualties are among all of us, and we haven't responded in a way that is coherent. And I'm not being critical of you. I'm not being critical of myself or anyone else listening. It takes a long time to do that. It took, for instance, I mean, you had a depression that began in 1929, and for instance, the auto industry wasn't organized for almost 10 years later. But thank you for your enthusiasm. I appreciate that. There's some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. And hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
This is Marion.
Hi, Marion. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Dearborn.
Well, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm calling for the first time in its history, the United States Postal Service is considering layoffs.
Really?
Benjamin Franklin, we haven't had one. And now in the, the government, the Federal Times and the postal newspapers, they're talking about layoffs, about eliminating, Saturday deliveries and calling for taking back part of our wages and things like that. And that's really odious. I mean, the whole ball of wax is, but...
Well, it's astounding that things have gotten to this point. I mean, the kind of national self-confidence that we once had, which not even so long ago, I mean, within all of our memories, has just dissipated completely. These people running things have made a total and absolute wreck of it. And as I said, one of the things that we have to do is just to get to the center of the waste and corruption and racketeering that really defines this system. I mean, if you think about it, remember, I don't know, you call every once in a while, so you may listen frequently, but I was talking that there's two economies. One is the one that 95% of us is involved in, and that is either, most of us, 80% of us, work, and then we either produce goods or services, and we get wages, and we try to do what we can with it to make the kind of life and living and future for us and our families. And then there's a few people that own things, and they hire people, and that company provides goods and services, and they make a profit. But then there's this whole sector of this system that apparently the people running things seem to think is a key to it all. It's called the stock market. It's this big Ponzi scheme where people are able to make fortunes, billions and billions and billions of dollars, by not producing any good or services, but doing something that's called investing. Well, I don't quite get that. I mean, it used to be if you invested, you capitalized a company. That is to say, Marion, you wanted to start a hamburger stand and you needed $50 because you needed 150. All you had was 100. And I'll say, okay, I'll give you $50, but when profits come in, I want 3%. And you say, or 5%, or that's not very good, but I want 7%. And you'd say, okay, and then I would be a stockholder and I'd be an owner and that would be the function within. But somehow then I begin selling my stock and with against future profits for a year, and then somebody else buys that and it's combined in these packages, and then it'd have these what they call financial instruments that nobody other than these technicians can even understand. So it's not a democratic work and wage system, a work, wage, and wealth system. It is absolutely obscured. It's opaque. It's absolutely undemocratic. And ultimately, since it is a huge Ponzi scheme, it collapses. And that's what's happened now. And as I've said over and over again, you didn't do anything wrong. I didn't do anything wrong. No one listening did anything wrong. It's all these ultra-rich guys that have us, well, by the short hairs. So that'll include everybody in that. All right, Marion, thank you very much. Jeez, it's... Whew. All right, let's continue onward. Hi, you're on the air. It's Night Call on WRIF. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Peter, thanks for taking my call. I apologize. I'm not keeping in contact with you on a weekly basis. I've been pretty tied up, like most people, working for more than one company.
I hear you. Who's this?
My name's Chris. I'm from Warren. I do security on the side, and I'm actually doing security with an automotive supplier as we speak. I can't give out any more information.
Okay. Go ahead,
but,
Chris.
Oh, my goodness. There's so many things I always like to discuss with you. The first thing and foremost is I'm tired of these people crying about, you know, if they're going to go from union wages to non-union wages. Join the bandwagon. I've been working 2-3 jobs sometimes trying to support my family and dealing with this where these other people are crying because they no longer can live their lifestyle, make it $24 an hour, that they might have to go down to $12 an hour.
Wait. I don't understand this. I mean, why wouldn't you think that this is a goal, that nobody should have to work 3 jobs? I mean, you have a family, Chris. You should be with them. It's criminal that you're not making enough out of one job. And it's been unions throughout our history that have led the way for everything from wages and benefits and retirement and health care and all of that. And without unions, who leads the way? Who acts for all the non-union people? Because there's nothing that unions do in the legislative field that doesn't affect every single worker. If they're at a particular workplace, well, then sure, they're going to get their wages and they're going to try to, you know, get a fair wage and what have you. But ultimately, everything from the weekend to Social Security and 100 other different things that you probably take for granted, and even the worst paying, non-union shop gives as a matter of right, like 40-hour week. I mean, people died to get 40-hour week. And you know who led that? You know who died? Again, it was union people 100 years ago. I mean, 40-hour week? You don't even know what a 40-hour week is, do you?
No, it's more hours than that. And Peter, if I could share with you,
sure.
Like you said earlier, should Bush be held accountable for the situation our country's in? Yes, he should be blamed, along with half of his entire cabinet. And not only are troops dying innocently, but a lot of these issues that evolve around our country should be blamed on his watch. And you can blame all the people who also voted for him. They're finally waking up and realizing that he was more of a pompous person than he would like to be.
All right. Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate you joining me. Let's see. Here is Patrick is in Taylor. Patrick, hi. It's Peter at 313-298-WRIF. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I wanted to talk about Israel and Palestine.
Sure.
But to talk about it, first we got to rewind and we got to go back to America and the Second War. Our government got together and decided it cost too many American lives to go over there and invade it. Instead, what we did was we invented napalm. We went over there in one night and killed about 80,000 civilians.
Where is it here? What are you talking about?
This is in 1945.
Oh, in Europe?
Yes.
Yes, you are absolutely right.
About 2 weeks later, we gave our ingredients to Great Britain. They did the same thing. To make a long story short, we went after the civilians. They turned on the government. Then here come Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That ended the war.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to speed up to the present. Israel had to go over there and do what they had to do because Hamas is embedded with the civilians. There's nothing they can do about it. There is going to be collateral damage.
Well, it's a little more than collateral damage. It's fundamental central damage. In fact, as it turns out, the Hamas fighters are probably the collateral damage. It's the Palestinian civilians that are taking it all. And again, I mean, you seem to know history. Well, you gotta go all the history. You gotta go back a year. You gotta go back, to 1967. You gotta go back to 1948. And it's not like, there's this one side that is, democratic and peaceful and doesn't want to take anybody's land. And on the other hand, you have all these crazy Arabs that just kind of came out of nowhere and hate the Jews and want to destroy Israel. I mean, that's...
Well, if we did that, what would happen if the American Indian rose up against us?
Well, that is actually a very good analogy. People keep saying, well, what do you think if somebody was in Mexico lobbing rockets into El Paso or something like that? I'd say, well, if it was just some people who were insane, but what if it was, Native people that said, hey, wait a minute, you've stolen our land. You know, if you think about the way that the American Indian, the Native Americans, were portrayed by the settlers, and that's, Israel is a settler state, just like the United States and Canada and South Africa and New Zealand, Australia, and there were other people living here and all those other countries, and they displaced those people. Usually it's total ethnic cleansing. And when you make the mistake, when the settlers make the mistake of not doing a thorough ethnic cleansing the way the United States has in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, you want a situation like you have in South Africa. You have this enormous population that says that eventually rises up. Well, you have the same situation in Palestine. I mean, you had a country that in 1946 was about 98% Palestinian, and by 2008 it's about 10% Palestinian. That's called ethnic cleansing.
Right, right. But then it always goes all the way back to 2,000 years ago when those were God's chosen people and that was their land, you know, and then they got separated and got taken over to Russia, and then Russia put them back over there after Hitler tried exterminating the Jews. So we can go back 2,000 years ago when they were fighting it. The Palestine's going to say it's their land, and the Jews are going to say it's their land. But here's the thing. Palestine is being flooded with money from Iran and Iraq. But those people choose right now. You can get $20,000 to $30,000, American dollars, if you strap a bomb to yourself and go in Israel. Now, to a 14-year-old,
that's a lot of money. Well, no one has taken them up on that in the recent times, although I'm pretty surprised that that hasn't been happening, because suicide bombers or truck bombs are sort of the poor man's F-16. You know, if you don't have that kind of sophisticated weaponry provided by the United States, like we do for Israel to the tune of billions of dollars a year, well, you go with, sort of homemade weapons. Pretty grisly. We can't... we think that's pretty odd behavior, but I don't know. It is, I guess, but it shows you the desperation. All right, thank you very much. I got to take a break, and we will be right back. Open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF. I'm Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan off for the evening.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Home of WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert listings, and where Riff is rocking the streets. Check out Motor City's deals and deals and get stuff for half price. Or hear 101 The Riff online from anywhere in the world.
Website
worldwide. 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
Fox Sports Detroit is looking for a new song for our 2009 April in the Deep promotion. Do you have what it takes to compose the music that fans will sing this spring? Prices include $5,000, a music video, and a live performance at the WRIF Tigers home opener party at the Fillmore Theater. Go to aprilinthed.com for rules and details. Find out how to enter April in the D, coming this spring to Fox Sports Detroit.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing. We want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new MKS, the MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. You can check out our vehicle inventory on the site, and you can bet that if you don't see what you're looking for, we can surely find it for you. Experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today. 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com. That's DEMMER.com.
Experience the Demmer difference. Right now at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury, lease a 2009 Lincoln MKS for $379 a month. Based on an AZ plan with Ford Lincoln Mercury lease renewal and $1,969 down plus tax. See dealer for details or check them out on the web at Demmer.com.
Imagine having the money for liposuction, a nose job, or tummy tuck. Well, now you can get the cosmetic procedure you want from an independent the independent board-certified surgeons managed by Doctors Say Yes are making cosmetic procedures affordable to everyone. Now you can afford the treatment you want with financing guaranteed, no matter what your credit looks like. If you've been thinking about becoming the perfect you, just call Doctors Say Yes at 1-866-495-8189. Their independent board-certified surgeons have assisted over 30,000 people, and they can help you afford the cosmetic procedure you've always always wanted. Call Doctors Say Yes for your free consultation. Call 1-866-495-8189. Your call is confidential with no obligation. Call 1-866-495-8189. That's 1-866-495-8189.
Is your credit score holding you back? Are you paying more for everything just because you don't have perfect credit? Well, it's not your fault. Credit card companies are doing everything they can to keep you in debt and never let you escape. But I've got a system that can fix your credit score once and for all. And I'm going to send you a free tape showing you the power of my proven system today.
My credit score is now 758. My wife and I are shouting for joy right now.
Hi, I'm John Commuta, creator of the Transforming Debt into Wealth system. My system doesn't just fix your credit score, it will permanently rebuild your credit status so it can never come back to haunt you again. It works no matter how bad your credit is or how much debt you have.
Our credit score was in the low 600s and now we're at 780.
You can wipe the slate clean once and for all. Call right now and I'll rush you my free tape. For your free tape, call 1-800-337-1713. That's 1-800-337-1713. 1-800-337-1713.
Attention! Hydralyze is currently seeking participants with dark circles and puffy eyes. If you have dark circles or bags around your eyes due to heredity, fatigue, or aging, you are now eligible to try Hydralyze free. Hydralyze was introduced to improve delicate skin around the eyes and now has been shown to eliminate dark circles and bags. It effectively diminishes even dark circles caused by heredity. To participate in the Hydralyze trial and see results risk-free, call 1-800-505-7931. Fragile capillaries around the eye can leak, allowing blood to pool beneath the skin like an ugly bruise. But right now, you can join the thousands of people who have seen their dark circles fade away, watched as bags literally disappeared from view. Participate in the free trial by calling today. If you're serious about getting rid of your dark circles or bags around the eyes, you are eligible to participate and experience a free trial of Hydralyze. For your free trial, call this number today, 1-800-505-7931, 1-800-505-7931.
101.1 WRIF, WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Jalene Jordan off for the evening. She'll be back next week. Our number's here, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. It shouldn't be a shock to you that we are talking about the Israeli invasion of Gaza and the thousands of civilian casualties that the operation is causing, and also the economy. See, Joe writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and I mentioned earlier about that Laura had scared up $500,000 China set so people could eat on it, right? The Bush China was a mere $500,000, says Joe, compared to the $6.2 billion for the George H.W. Bush aircraft carrier the Bush crime family christened this weekend. I'm sure Junior will get his within the next 10 years. That could be, yeah. Let's see here if I got another one. Jeff in Canton writes, good evening, Pete. All we're hearing about is what's going on with Israel. How come we aren't hearing anything about the massacre in Congo? Yeah, you know, that is just a horrible set of circumstances. A, that is happening at all, and B, that we don't focus on Africa. You think about what happened in Rwanda during the 1990s, that intense focus on the Serbian massacres of Kosovars in Kosovo, in Bosnia. And, you know, while Rwanda was even a higher total, I guess it's just this ethnocentrism, right? Well, you know, they won't quit. I keep thinking that Sarah Palin, that her name pretty soon is going to be like Monica Lewinsky. Just people go, oh yeah, I remember, kind of chuckle a little. But that she still thinks she has a future. Remember the other one just, her future was, what'd she do, sell handbags or something like that. But anyway, I always thought that Palin probably has some advisors that say, you got to get out of the limelight, because every time you open up your mouth, you look bad. Everything you say, everything that happens to you and your family, just digs you in deeper. But no, she won't quit. I don't know if you saw all this, but there was this right-wing talk show host, Don Ziegler, and he's putting together a documentary on why Obama won. I mean, from a distorted right-wing view, of course. I mean, he thinks that Obama just wasn't playing fair, you know, unlike George W. Bush, who stole two elections in a row. In any event, Palin now is questioning whether Carolyn Kennedy is getting better treatment from the press. She's trying to become the senator from New York than she said she received at the hands of the media. And she says now that even these Ziegler interview posted YouTubes, that they were taken out of context. And where was this here? She was and she was claiming she was exploited by Tina Fey on Saturday Night Live. And she says she told Ziegler that CBS News anchor Katie Couric and comic actress Tina Fey had been, quote, exploiting her. You know, there's nothing lower and more pathetic than a politician who's whining, wah, 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 all right, you know, I could have been a contender, you know, but they made me look bad. Well, why were you so, what's the word? Why were you such an available target? You know, people said about Barack Obama, they couldn't find anything funny about the guy. There's a lot to ridicule about John McCain, and, you know, you saw all that. But the humor, even attempts at right-wingers to do humor about Obama didn't do it because he's, you know, well-centered, well-spoken. He's dignified and doesn't have all the, you know, the horrible history and the gaffes that these two characters of the Republicans put up. But she was just whining and whining away. She singled out the Couric interview as condescending, particularly a question about what she reads. And according to the governor, what do you guys do up there? In fact, Couric never asked that question, but did press unsuccessfully for the governor to state specific newspapers she read, which Palin never did. And she didn't end on this interview with this sympathetic right winger. So it's the gift that just keeps on giving. Wow, I want it just quit, huh? And remember that other numbnuts, Joe the Plumber, what's his name? Samuel J. Wurzelbacher from south of Toledo, the plumber who really wasn't even a plumber, at least officially. I mean, he could do so. I could do plumbing, but you got to be certified. Well, he's traded in his tool belt, according to this report, and now he's gone over to Israel to be a war correspondent for a right-wing website. So what are his qualifications? He's famous for being famous. At least he was made famous by McCain and Palin. By the way, Palin was involved in such dirty tricks. I shouldn't say tricks. I mean, the Republicans did pull a lot of dirty tricks. But she, just in her rhetoric, the way she attempted over and over again to tie Barack Obama to that ex-weatherman from, you know, 40 years ago or something like that. I mean, you know, hey, what did Harry Truman say? If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. So it's quit whining, Sarah Palin. And Joe's defending Israel, Joe the plumber, and he says, well, the citizens of Israel can't do the normal things day to day, like wash their hair because of the fear of Hamas's rockets. Well, it's glad he's over there to make that observation. I could have told him that. Just sitting here in Detroit, right? But he says that he thinks that, where is this? That he said that, he thinks that the media should not cover the war. That it shouldn't cover the war. It should not. What's he doing over there? That's what he's doing. But he says the media should not cover the war. Instead, it should return to World War II reporting with the public watching weeks-old footage in theaters. Bye-bye, CNN, right? They've got footage that no one else does. Also, this never quits, does it? Senator Wydestand, Senator Larry E. Craig, now gone, formerly Republican senator from Ohio, who got busted in a Minneapolis bathroom stall and an airport sex sting. And he says he is withdrawing his effort to withdrawing his guilty plea. He's ending his effort to withdraw his guilty plea. So that's going to stand, but so you would think he's forever humiliated, embarrassed, and whatever, even though he said, I am not gay. But he did not run for re-election last year. Another Republican got it. And he's going to start a consulting group. Hey, these guys do when they get bounced out of office. And he's going to work on a book about his time as a senator. Okay. Well, that's good. So anything else? No, that's it. So why won't these guys just go away? All right, Peter Werby here with you, 313-298-WRIF. And here's Jason. He's in Ypsilanti. Jason, thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Oh, thank you, Peter. Very interesting show, as usual.
Thank you.
I wanted to say something about the economy, but
sure.
I've been listening to a couple of your callers talking about Israel, and I just wanted to say something really quickly about that. First, I think people's history on the whole Israel situation is very bad. They're just not well informed, and the American media has not informed them very well. They kind of, if you want to be informed about the history of the Israeli-Palestinian situation, you really have to educate yourself, preferably through books. There's a whole history there, and it's been very much unfair to the Palestinians since 1948.
Well, Jason, you're so 20th century. As you know, you can just go to the internet. I agree with you. You know how I feel about books. Very important to read. But if you want some shorthand stuff, actually, I should have said this earlier. All of this is on my website at Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E. It's peterwerbe.com. And besides comments on the current state of affairs, you can also click there, and that will take you to exactly the kind of history that Jason is suggesting that all of us need to know before we can make these pronouncements. But go ahead.
Yes, I just wish, you know, and I realize a lot of people get their history from the Bible, and they think that the Israelis that are there today are linked to the historic Jews of biblical times, but in fact, most of them are not. There's actually proof, genetic proof at this point, that a lot of them, and I'm not saying this really matters to me, but I think it matters in some people who are forming their opinions, maybe, that a lot of them are actually people of European descent called Khazars, or of a whole tribe that adopted the Jewish religion for political reasons in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
And it gets complicated, and I don't want to dwell on it, but it's just a fact.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
Anyway, I wanted to say something about the economy right now.
Sure.
You were commenting earlier on the source, what's the source of our problems? And I guess I've said it before, but I want to reiterate that our banking system is the source of our problems. The Federal Reserve System is designed to be unfair to the American people, and they need to realize that, and they need to educate themselves about that as well. And ever since it's been put in place, it's been operating under very deceptively in many ways, how they create inflation, this whole bailout is a product not of just the Bush administration, but of the banking establishment and Wall Street itself. This is how they think, and this is how they operate. You get, as you said, socialism for the rich and, you know, the free market, quote-unquote, for the rest of us.
Well, what's the one thing that's interesting, Jason? The official, and I think this was a good part of it, for the creation of the Federal Reserve System a little less than 100 years ago, was to stop exactly what's going on now. And so I guess it hasn't worked very well.
Well, right. They were to stop banking panics, because the powers that be, there's a lot of proof that they created the panic of 1907,
right,
which J.P. Morgan single-handedly stabilized the economy through his great wealth and then said, well, we can't go through that again, so he helped sponsor, you know, the pushing through of this Federal Reserve legislation, him and his friends, which has been detailed at this point to have been formed on, you know, Jekyll Island, a private resort owned by J.P. Morgan in Georgia at the time, and then pitched to the American people a few years later. And if anyone really looks at the Federal Reserve System very closely, they're going to see a lot of questions, and more questions than answers, really, because a lot of it is shrouded in secrecy. We don't even really know who owns the Federal Reserve System, and I say owns because it is, in fact, a private bank, a profit-making institution, and not really part of the federal government. It is nominally, we appoint governors, but the shareholders and many of the governors are really selected privately.
I wonder if they're actually making money through all of this. But, this is a very, very complicated question. And you're right. This is something I would suggest reading about in a book, not even online. It's so complicated. But are you just saying that if we just got rid of the Federal Reserve System, period, boom, like that, and that would kind of solve our problems?
No, there's actually a very good movie available online called The Money Masters that talks about a lot of this. I don't 100% agree with all of it, but a lot of it is very, very informative. It's a good starting point. I would say very quickly that what we need to do is have a banking system that operates for the American people. Right now, money is loaned into existence. We don't even just print our own money, which can be bad enough. We actually have to borrow it from the Fed and pay interest on it. Why? I don't know. It supposedly insulates us from being too crazy and overspending, which is what we're doing now anyway. There's supposed to be like an independent break on our, you know, passion for just, you know, buying everything we might want.
Well, now there's going to be no break whatsoever. In fact, the fear is if we don't print enough and spend enough that we're just going to sink ourselves into maybe a decade of recession, or you can really expand that into a worst-case scenario where everything, literally the whole productive mechanism, which includes agriculture, just grinds to a halt. So, what you're suggesting, Jason, I think is not on the agenda.
I agree. It's not. I mean, obviously, you can't rely on the elites who are benefiting from the situation to fix our problems.
Right.
But what the American people need to do very quickly is educate themselves very carefully. Don't rely on the same people who got us into this mess to explain how to get out of it. We've got to look at history. Our forefathers understood this, and this is, you know, I'll say something really quick. The Wizard of Oz, everyone knows the Wizard of Oz. It was a book written by Frank Baum, a progressive journalist in Chicago, and he wrote it as a parable, kind of like Jonathan Swift, you know, was writing Gulliver's Travels, about the banking system of this country.
Yeah, it was.
And it's supposed to it helped educate the people about standing up for themselves.
And don't look behind the curtain, because you see it's all being manipulated. All right, Jason, thank you very much. Good advice. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. And I want to tell you that at 1 a.m., which is in about 45 minutes, I'll be interviewing Kim Fellner. It's called the book she wrote. It's called Wrestling with Starbucks, Conscience, Capital, and Cappuccino. And the interview came out a lot differently than I thought. I thought she was going to be a 100% critic of Starbucks, and she's a labor person too. So it's an interesting interview that happens at 1 a.m. Way up to Flint, Michigan. Here's Garrett. Garrett, thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hey, Peter. Great show tonight.
Thank you.
I'd like to get back to the Israel thing.
Sure.
And I was just wondering what your take on this is. When you have, you know, when the average American is watching the news or reading the news or whatever, and they see that on one side people siding with the Palestinians are, you know, saying that Israel's using things like white phosphorus, you know, melting skin off people and things like that, and, you know, who knows what else. And then, you know, you can change the channel or flip the page and see that Israel's saying, no, we're not. You know, we're not using this. What is the average American like to think about that? Like, what are they supposed to make of that when you have
two sides, you know, saying that that all the casualties are the responsibility of Hamas for beginning the rocketing of breaking the ceasefire, which is their narrative. They unilaterally broke the ceasefire. They precipitated what no country would tolerate. This is what Israel said. They're doing their best to not have civilian casualties because Hamas uses launch sites for rockets right within civilian areas that they can't help it. That's their narrative. So what? So the Palestinians say that there's a long history before this, that in fact it was Israel that manipulated the ceasefire into a situation where they knew Hamas would respond, that this was long planned, that they're using terrible weapons of destruction, that the main it turns out that whether the Israelis want it or not, the main targets are, well, maybe call them targets because they're not aiming at them, but the main victims of it all is the civilian population. It must be horribly traumatized. It would be like the United States Marines going in and fighting a war in Manhattan. I mean, if you can imagine that. Are you with me?
I can't really, but it just seems like, you know, it seems there's a lot of confusion on the subject, and, you know, I just by default, I always side on the people being oppressed, the people being murdered. You know, it's, I think it's always a safer bet that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, most people will turn on the television and see, you know, the authority on the matter saying, no, everything they're saying is wrong. And this
well, haven't we learned by now if they're on TV and they got suits on, they're probably lying? I mean, isn't that the main message? If you see anybody on television, they have a suit on, they're lying. I mean, you would be, I'm not saying everyone is, but you would do much, much better to begin that as a premise and then go from there and go, oh, well, wait a minute. I just learned this, and this time this particular person isn't lying to me. But usually you get terrible misinformation off of television. I've told people before, I do this for a living, and I would say I get zero information from television. And if I thought that there was good stuff there, I would watch it all the time. And then I wouldn't have to look at the Internet, and I wouldn't have to read newspapers. I wouldn't have to read magazines. I wouldn't have to read books like I do. But here's an image. Think about Indians attacking a wagon train. And think of, remember I was using this phrase, a narrative. Can you imagine going, you know, leaving from Iowa and you're going across the plains, you're in these buckboards and these covered wagons, and suddenly these ferocious Indians come and want to kill you. They want to destroy you. They kill everybody they can. They take, you know, women and children as hostages. To the settlers, these are the most awful incarnation of evil, they are completely at a loss to interpret the behavior of these, quote, savages, except that they are, as I said, they just represent everything that's evil. Well, you turn that and you look at the people doing that. And they realized that there was invasion of their country by European people of European ancestry, and if they didn't stop the white man, as we've come to call him in these kind of cowboy narratives and settler narratives, that their way of living would be destroyed. Well, I mean, I'm not saying I support attacking wagon trains, but their narrative was in fact correct. The Native American narrative was correct, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. They had a land that they controlled from sea to sea, and now they're just kind of jammed in these reservations. Most of them are. I don't even know if they're all in bad conditions now, because now they run gambling casinos. That's kind of quite a step down from what they were when the first European settler came and said hi. You know, with a big smile on his face. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here's John, who's driving on the road. John, I got to tell you, I just heard something that they said. Talking on cell phones driving has led to thousands of deaths. Take it easy.
Yeah, well, apparently Michigan forgot how to use salt. Since I crossed the Ohio state line, there was no salted roads whatsoever.
Really?
So, absolutely.
Yeah,
so,
what's happening?
I just heard a lot about, you know, I'm a lifelong Michigander, lived here 40 years, and I decided to pack my bags down to the state so I could actually make a living. And I've heard a lot of people whining so far. First I heard unionizing the people in the Saturn plant, which I thought that's kind of silly. Or actually not Saturn, but, you know, the Tennessee plants.
Sure.
And then I heard a postal worker complain about their wages get cut, and I'm thinking, what kind of education do you need to carry mail? And then I heard another guy wanted to work three jobs or something like that and making $10 an hour. And I decided to leave. I make $22 an hour, and I certainly make a nice living, and I don't have to have a union. So I don't know. I find Michiganders now have a little bit of a blinders on. They don't tend to see beyond the state's border anymore, and they think the rest of the country is in bad shape like the state is. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, it's not like that.
Well, I'll tell you, John, you know, to most people, or I don't know, most people, but probably to good numbers of people listening, $22 an hour sounds like a king's ransom almost, but that comes out to be $44,000 a year, and if you have a family, even that isn't very easy to live on.
Well, I must agree, and that's, you know, for my position, actually, that's the entry-level paying, so can't tell you where I work.
Well, it's okay, but listen, you know, there's something that really hits me wrong when I hear what you said about, the person doesn't even necessarily have a good education. I mean, what does it have? I mean, why shouldn't we all share in what once was this enormous wealth of this country? I mean, somebody's got to flip the burger. Someone's got to push the broom. Someone's got to work in the, you know, the forge and the foundry. Someone's got to clean the toilet. Someone's got to sweep up the medical waste and all of that. And to me, almost those jobs should be, because they're pretty distasteful, although very, very, very necessary. These people should be rewarded well, because it's not a matter of someone should have a PhD, then they automatically get a lot of money. We should do it as a matter of thinking we live within a community that their husband does, they get a $2,000 handbag, and someone else is working their butt off to clean the toilet that you're going to stop in at the rest stop, and they're making $6 an hour.
Right, but that's a Michigan thing, though. Basically, I'll give you an example. My girlfriend's from West Virginia. She left there, and she delivers mail for a university and makes $12 an hour. So the problem that you have here in Michigan is there's too many people for whatever jobs there are. For me to get the same paying job up here, exact same style job, I'll be making $12 an hour here.
Well, wait a minute, John. What if everybody takes your advice? Then people are, you can have, hundreds of thousands, millions of people on the road, try to find where's the good jobs. I mean, you know what I think? There used to be a phrase, I haven't even heard it in years. People used to say, the world doesn't owe you a living. I think it does. I think that the world owes us a calm, centered life where we can work and do our work, whether it's at the university or, as I said, cleaning a toilet or being a lawyer or being a security guard or whatever, and not have to worry about the rug being pulled out from under us, not making so little that we can't even get what we need for ourselves or our family, that if you're 22 or 23 years old, you can work your butt off and still have to live with your, with your parents. All right, thank you. I should say, what is it? Drive now, talk later. That's it. Actually, there was just this study came out that said that people talking on cell phones have been the cause of a couple thousand fatalities and thousands of accidents. But I'm always back to, a couple of these callers. It so lacks compassion or an understanding. I mean, we are all in this together, and it doesn't always look like it, but one of the things is this politics of resentment, they don't deserve $22 an hour because they don't have a good education, or, I only make $9 an hour, and their union's getting destroyed, and they're going to be making $9 an hour more. They'll be down the pit with me, rather than understanding that those, not only that those are goals that we should aspire to, because if these people did it, we can do it. But they didn't do it by themselves. This is part of a literally 150, if you really stretch it, or at least 100-year struggle for working people to have a decent life. Because the ruling elite, the economic elite of this country, saw us as nothing but slaves. We weren't chattel slaves the way Africans were. We were wage slaves. They owned us. And a lot of times they kept us in company towns. They worked us 14 to 16 hours a day. They made sure that we were strung on credit so we could never leave. And when, particularly back in the 1880s, but through like the 1940s, if we had the temerity to get together to say, hey, we want a dollar an hour more. We want some time off. We want retirement. We want a weekend. We want to get rid of child labor. We want to produce products that aren't dangerous and poisonous. They'd call out the cops. They'd call out the private guards. They'd call out the National Guard and shoot down men, women, and children because people wanted something really radical, like an eight-hour day. And it's all about distribution of income. We've had these discussions before because if I'm working for you, let me put it another way. I'll bet you there's 2% of you are owners that have people working for them. And I know people that own companies. I'm not saying, like you're these evil guys. And it's not even a question of evil. It's how the, society is structured. But I'm working for a company and they're paying me $100 a week to work, and I have to work 60 hours, 60 hours, a week. In order to get my $100. Well, I go on strike, and I want to strike for a 40-hour week for the same amount of money. But that's a distribution of income. That's redistribution of income. It's a fight for who controls the wealth, and that's what it's always been. I used an example a few weeks ago that if I'm working for an employer, and I'm making $100 a week, and I say, boss, I've been working here a long time. I want $105. That's redistribution. I'm asking for redistribution of income. Because he has $5 less, I have $5 more. But it shouldn't be a class struggle. That's what's always been under capitalism. It's always been a class struggle in that radical manner. And that's because the people that have it, the elite, the rulers, they'll never give it up. It doesn't matter if they have billions, like Walmart. They could afford to pay everybody $50 an hour. They could afford to pay people $100 an hour. Every single one of their employees, they could give $100 an hour, and they would still be worth billions. Hear that? They could pay the Walmart family, the Waltons. They could pay every single one of their employees $100 an hour, and they would still be worth billions. Why wouldn't they do that? Because it's pathological. And it's allowed. And that's what we've got to go at. And if we started saying, hey, wait a minute, we're going to create that situation. We're going to have our wages based on what the company's capacity to pay is. Well, all hell would break loose because they wouldn't say, well, wait a minute, we'll still have the, it's mine, it's ours. Well, you didn't work for it. Your daddy gave it to you. I don't care. It's mine. Well, everybody working for you doesn't make enough to rise above the poverty level or, you know, they're at least near poor, if not poor. I don't care. It's mine. And that's what the real sickness of this society is. I mean, it gets manifest in the bank, the Federal Reserve, and all that. But ultimately, it's a kind of ethical positioning that this society is run on. Okay, I'm going to take a break. 313-298-WRIF. I'll be right back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. On your radio, on your computer, and now on your brand new iPhone 3G. Your new Apple iPhone 3G connect you to 101 WRIF from anywhere in the world.
Damn, I'm going to get you
on. Log on and listen worldwide at WRIF.com.
Your credit card debt is getting out of control. You're having trouble making the monthly minimums. Sound familiar? You have to do something, but what? Well, you don't have to file for bankruptcy. The mortgage brokers want you to put up your family home to pay off credit card debts. Problem is that more often than not, you find yourself using the credit cards again. Only this time there's no equity left in your home, and you have a whole new pile of credit card debt. It doesn't have to be this way. We're Credit Card Relief. We help people just like you get out of debt in months instead of years, and save you thousands of dollars. Call now for a free consultation. We're an attorney-driven program with an excellent reputation. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 1-866-290-8282. 1-866-290-8282. Not available in all states. 1-866-290-8282.
Please stay tuned to the following public announcement. The government and private banks are liquidating houses now. These houses have been foreclosed, confiscated, or repossessed, and will be sold. Homes may be sold for very little money down. To learn how to receive a free list of foreclosures, call 800-354-8211. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N are allowed to start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Every house must be sold. The government and banks are very motivated to sell these homes quickly, so listings may not always remain available in all areas. So act now. I repeat, this is a public announcement. All listeners whose last name begins with the letter A through N can start calling now. Listeners whose last name begins with O through Z can begin calling tomorrow, 9 a.m. Call CRN's national toll-free hotline to learn how to receive your free foreclosure list at 800-354-8211. That's 800-354-8211.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. I'll be with you till 1 a.m. A very interesting interview at that time with an author who's written a book about Starbucks. Little do we know about that coffee we swill, right? Here's another couple of, I don't know, pretty much disgraceful items, but that shows you how low we've sunk here. The Venezuelan government, you may know, it has been subsidizing a couple hundred thousand poor people for discounted fuel oil in the United States. And why this is disgraceful, think about that. What, the United States having to accept charity from a foreign nation. A lot of people have a negative opinion of Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela. But quickly in your mind, think, why? Oh, because he made fun of George W. Bush, right? That's not so bad. But anyway, for a couple of days, they announced through its U.S. oil subsidiary, Citgo, that they were going to end the free home heating oil to poor Americans. But there was such concern that they actually reinstated it. Now, it's run, interestingly, by Joseph P. Kennedy II, who is the son of Robert F. Kennedy. And he bears the name of his grandfather, who was the Kennedy brother's father. And this is one of the reasons why Jalene and I always get our gasoline, even when it was $4 a gallon, at Citgo. I mean, it's bad enough to have to pay for it, but at least, you know, some of it's come back to the poor. None of it is going to rich stockholders. Think about that. Every time you buy any of those others, it's all going to rich shareholders of the particular company. There's no shareholders whatsoever of the Venezuelan national oil. It all goes, I mean, that's essentially the government's revenue. And they're kind of screwed now because of the way it's dropping. But anyway, this is still available. And if you have a pen, if you're unable to pay your heating bill, and there are restrictions like an income and all that, there's a toll-free hotline number. It's 877-JOE-4OIL. And that's J-O-E, the numeral 4, O-I-L. So in, let's see, as of January 19th, you can do it. Yeah. JOE-4OIL, 877-JOE-4OIL. And you may, I don't know what the system is now. I mean, I remember I interviewed Joseph Kennedy II. Maybe 2 years ago or so. Also, a Detroit elementary school is asking for donations of toilet paper and light bulbs to continue functioning. I mean, how low can we go? Come on. And still, there's that rich lady in New York City who's going to fork over $2,000 for her hobo handbag. Sweet. Susie in Dearborn Heights. Susie, hi. It's Peter Werby on WRIF. Thanks for joining me.
Hi.
Hi.
This is not what I called him, but I have to make a comment about the pompous guy that just called about his talking about the college-educated people getting the jobs. Not everyone has the opportunity to go to college. Not everybody has rich parents who can pay for it or can get scholarships or can make the kind of money to go to college to get an education. Some people just have to support themselves right off the bat.
Sure.
And there needs to be jobs for people with decent rates for people who have just a high school diploma.
Or less. I mean, everybody should have a decent, what they call a living wage. And there are tens of millions of people in this country that do not make a living wage.
Oh, right. And, you know, what does this guy suggest that these people who don't have college educations and can't get a decent job, what does he suggest that they do? Go stay in a homeless shelter or something?
Well, no, here's the attitude that comes out of people like John and also Chris, who called earlier. These are people that work so hard. And like Chris said, he has three jobs. Remember, you may remember that President Bush was complimenting some woman a couple of years ago. She said, you know, she works three jobs. Give her a big hand. Nobody should have to work three jobs in order to make a living wage. It ought to be codified into our laws that we, as a matter of course, make a wage because of our contribution. I mean, think about the absolute worst job. I mean, one of the things that I can think of, and there's probably few of you out there that are doing this. Clean public toilets. Clean toilets in a public area. But think how important that is. I mean, I always say, what would you rather have? Clean toilets or, I mean, who would you rather have a strike of? Put it that way. The people that clean the toilets or lawyers.
Right. Well, what I really called
Go.
Was that, you know, I do inventory for an inventory company. And a lot more stores beside Macy's and Lynn's and things are closing.
Sure.
That's Value City and Michael's and Circuit City and Lazy Boy.
Wow.
And this is just before Christmas. No store wants to close before Christmas because they always hope that they're going to get saved by Christmas.
Sure.
Now that Christmas is past, now we're going to start hearing about them every week. Every week stores are going to be closing. Well, for me, every time a store closes, that's another day of work that I don't get. And now they've decided our company, since they can do this now, there are no jobs and the recession happening, they're cutting our pay. You know, that I've worked there for 11 years. It took me 11 years to get to $12 an hour. And now they're going to cut my pay, $2.22 an hour.
Oh, this is criminal.
You know, just because they can. Because what choice do I have? It's not like I can go out and find another job right now. You can't even get a job at McDonald's right now.
No, I know. Although McDonald's is one of the few businesses, along with Walmart's, that's showing a profit.
Well, I won't go to Walmart's first.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just, you know, this is, you know, I've been hearing this from everybody that the pays are getting cut, that they're cutting their pay. You know, if you're non-union, well, even union now, because they can.
Well, let me say this. If an enterprise is not doing well, you want to reduce costs, and labor is what they call variable capital. In other words, that price of labor can go up and down. I mean, it's very possible if you had a union, you could make $20 an hour. Or if they really wanted to be horrible, they give you $7 an hour. So it's variable. The rest of the stuff, pencils or whatever you use, that's kind of a fixed capital or fixed cost. Let's call labor a variable cost. But here, and one could say that in a period where business and a revenue stream is reduced, one could say, look, workers, if we don't drop the costs here, we're not going to have a business. And so we're going to have to cut everybody $2.20 an hour. And you go, oh, my God, that's horrible. How can this be done to me? But it could be, and I'm not saying this is, Susie, because a lot of times companies, in fact, very frequently companies in times like this, use it to attack labor, particularly organized labor, as we're seeing. But what they will not do, when things turn around, when they start making an expanded profit, they're not going to say, Susie, you were so great to take in the others, taking 220-hour cut, and essentially over the years, over the 3 years, that wound up to be $7,000. We're going to give you a $7,000 bonus, and since we're doing so good, we're going to raise you to $20 an hour over what you were previously making. They're never going to do this. So it's always us who has to eat it. Susie, I'm going to move on. So thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Boy, that makes me so angry. I just can't even. And it's not happening to me. Let's see. Here's Josh in Dearborn Heights. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hey, good evening, Peter Burby.
Hi.
Hi. My concern is definitely the economy in the state. Now, the one thing I do not understand, especially, I will give credit for Granholm and try to push this thing around, and she's been really bad within the generalized media of being pushed around.
Okay.
Now, the one thing is we do have some alternative energy sources, if you can hear, and you seem like you're well-read. Like, there's a plant over in Muskegon that they actually have all these factories here which are exporting these windmills to places like Thailand and stuff like that. Now, we have all these warehouses down here that are up to standards, some warehouses, not all of them are destroyed, which we can actually rehire some people, and wouldn't it take too long to train these people up? I do not understand within the House of Representatives and also Congress within the state that they cannot do that, because the training shouldn't be too hard to do. This is a little niche company that's making record profits that they could expand upon with that. And that's another thing I don't understand with this, too, with the big three, is they should have came around at least 20 years beforehand for electrical and everything else with alternative energy. Because they even said within Congress, and it really disturbed me, that they actually made their profit off of the bubble of the housing market.
Well, we had a guest earlier, actually a guest caller, Wendy Thompson, who actually put that forth, the idea of conversion. Just as she said, like during World War II, plants went over, were converted over to producing what was needed for the war, tanks and the lot. That the same way is that we have the industrial infrastructure here, and we have to get off of fossil fuel. I mean, it's wars and corruption, lives in our fortune, trying to maintain an economy of oil, which is the only reason we fought a war in Iraq, the only reason that we're in the Middle East at all. And things like coal are so toxic that we're poisoning ourselves. But that's a good idea. I'm going to have to move a little quick along here. Thank you for your call. Here, millions of tons of toxic coal ash is piling up in power plant ponds in 32 states, a situation the government has long recognized as a risk to human health and the environment, but has done nothing about. Gee, what a surprise, particularly in the last 8 years. 156 coal-fired power plants store ash in surface ponds similar to the one that ruptured last month in Tennessee. So one of the things that happens is they're man-made lagoons, and they have this mixture of non-combustible ingredients of coal and the ash trapped by equipment designed to reduce air pollution from the power plants. So we don't want this particulate matter coming out of there. So they have these filters, these scrubbers, and I forget what else they call them. Maybe filters and scrubbers. But then the residue there is totally toxic, totally poison. They go, what can we do with it? I don't know. Well, we're going to put it in a big pond. Well, now these ponds, like the one in Tennessee, broke. And it's just like the Detroit incinerator. This monstrous thing has been operating for the last 20 years or so. People started, the critics initially said this is going to be a financial boondoggle, which they were correct. It's going to be poisonous, which they were correct. But finally, they retrofitted it for tens of millions of dollars with these, I can't think of the other word, something in scrubbers. And then they wound up with all the toxic ash, which was good because it wasn't going out the smokestack and going over the east side of Detroit and Grosse Pointe and over to Windsor. But then they had this toxic ash. What do they do with that? So that's sort of a different subject. But one of the we don't want to be using coal. We don't want to be using oil, right? War, pollution, global warming, we want to move off of that stuff. Here's Lars in Madison Heights. Hi, Lars. Peter Werby. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Peter. I wanted to respond to an earlier caller who was trying to imply that brute force is what caused this victory in World War II.
Okay.
I think what people really fail to take into account is, the amount, the other things we had going on during World War II. I mean, like when we dropped the atomic bombs in Japan, we had already decimated their army, and it would have been inevitable anyway. It's like with Germany, it's like, if we had just started bombing civilians at the beginning, it doesn't mean that the civilians would have revolted. They would have rallied behind their government and taken even more extreme action against the Allies. And
okay.
The same thing happens in pretty much every war. When people are, as civilians are assaulted, it doesn't make them want to cave into the demands. It makes them hungry for blood.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly the analogy with Israel now, is that there was a Time magazine this week that said, I think essentially, why Israel is going to lose. But, I don't know, I don't want to have to repeat what I said an hour and a half ago, but in many ways, this invasion works for all the political forces there. For Israel, for Hamas, we say, works for, how could it work for Hamas? They're getting pummeled. There's thousands of casualties. Well, they've got strategies, I'm sure, that they figure are going to bring them to political power in the West Bank. But the casualties, as usual, the ordinary people, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
There's an ancient martial proverb, I'll censor it for the radio, but S rolls downhill.
What?
It's never going to reach the top. It's always going to affect the people at the bottom who didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, these people have lived such a miserable life for so long, and all the political forces involved are conspiring to assure that it continues to be miserable, even worse. I can't even imagine this. The trauma that these children must be experiencing. Just amazing. All right, thank you very much. By the way, we will have our podcast up. I keep thinking we. I mean, Jolene and I. Jolene will be back next week. But the podcast for this tonight's night call will be up at noon today, Monday. Well, let's see. Also, we have a MySpace page and a Facebook page, of which I have absolutely no idea whatsoever how to deal with. Where's our money going? How about this? The United States inaugurated its largest embassy ever last Monday. It's a fortress-like compound in the heart of the Green Zone in Iraq. It can be seen from the moon, and it cost you and me $700 million. You heard that? The embassy, the United States embassy in Iraq, costs $700 million. Ambassador Ryan Crocker proclaimed, Iraq is in a new era, and so is the Iraqi-U.S. relationship. What in the world could the United States need this enormous 104-acre site, 1,200 employees? It's 10 times the size of any other American embassy in the world. It doesn't sound like we're withdrawing, doesn't it? It doesn't seem like we're going to at all. In terms of all talk about traumatic, two aspects of what the Iraqi people have experienced because of George Bush's lies and war crimes. But also now the Pentagon has decided it will not award the Purple Heart, the hallowed medal given to those wounded or killed by enemy action, to war veterans who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder because it is not a physical wound. This is traditional. Yet we see, let's see if it has figures here. One in five service members, at least 300,000, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder or major depression, according to Rand Corporation study in 2008. Here was a war that was absolutely unnecessary, that everything that Bush and Cheney said about it was a lie. They knew it was a lie. They went ahead anyway. Remember the idea that they were going to welcome us as liberators? Well, hundreds of thousands of their casualties later and thousands of ours, and you have to take 300,000 men and women on our side that are suffering PTSD, and imagine what it's like to be in Iraq, the PTSD that is suffered there. But anyway, the disorder, which may go unrecognized for months or years, can include recurring nightmares, uncontrolled rage, and sometimes severe depression and suicide. Soldiers grappling with PTSD are often unable to hold down jobs, but no medal, guys. Sorry. The Army said Wednesday it had mistakenly sent 7,000 letters with the salutation, "Dear John Doe," to family members of soldiers who have died in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. All right, let's get some of our last haulers. May even be able to get a couple new callers. And 313-298-WRIF, you're Paul in Sterling Heights. Hi, Paul. It's Peter. Thanks for joining me on WRIF.
Hi, Peter. I'll try and keep this as short as possible. I've got a wonderful little success story on labor front and an anecdote I'd like to add if I have time, okay?
Sure, go ahead.
Here's a success story. I work at Ford Sterling plant. We've spoken before. I'm an electrician here.
Okay.
We almost went out on strike last week. And one of the things, in a framework of this auto bailout that's supposed to come with the fact that UAW is supposed to sign up on not being able to have a strike,
right,
it was because we're threatening to strike that it came to some resolution. And it happened like this. The backstory is a lot of guys from the plant started calling up every media outlet they could get to with this story. My plant maintains a construction crew. We're one of the few auto companies that still has construction crews in-house. We have always underbid outside contractors and completed projects before they thought were due. You got that?
Got it.
Okay. We underbid. We're moving a department in plant. We underbid the outside contractor by over $400,000. We offered to bring in people who were laid off from other plants so they would not have to pay for weekend overtime, and they still chose the outside contractor, which is against the local agreement and which would have led to a strike. You got that?
I do. Actually, we are running out of time, so tell me the success.
Okay. What happened was because we threatened to come to a strike, because they reconsidered, they're bringing in the guys who are laid off from outside Ford plants. And the best thing is the person they did hire was the supervision from the outside construction crew was really sort of, they can't accuse us of adding the job because the outside supervision is going to be, you know, the construction crew. And the guys in here actually are happy to work for somebody who's got a clue on how the job needs to be done.
So you wound up with the job? Tell me that, yes or no?
Yes. We got the job.
All right. We're going to have to leave that as the success story because I got to get one caller real quickly. It's Larry from Richmond. Larry, you got about 60 seconds. Are you with me, brother?
Yeah. Okay. Amen, brother. There's a lot of things that you say that I really agree with, and I'm glad to see that some people out there still can visualize on, the work ethics of a lot of the UAW people. I'm from Sterling myself also, just like the last caller. And but what I wanted to say was, the guy John that called up with this $12 an hour, is he living with his mom? Because, I mean, you can't with a family raise a family on $12 an hour and still pay for your gas, your food, utilities, which are all skyrocketing.
Yeah, well, actually, Larry, he said $22 an hour, but even that, $44,000 a year. That's if you got three people more in the family, that's hard. But oh, you're right, that $12 an hour figure that sounds very attractive to many people winds up in a situation where you're in what they call near poverty. Larry, I'm sorry to rush it through, but I got to go. I got to get these commercials in before we do our interview, so next time we'll talk longer. Thanks for calling me. Angeline Jordan will be back next week. Pete Werby here saying thanks so much for listening and for calling. I have an interview about Starbucks coming up. It's that coffee we drink, good, bad, problem, visionaries. We'll find out right after these.
This is NutCall on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more NutCall right after this.
Fast.
$9 million.
All of you have stuck with me.
Divided by 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now you get much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text messages at the RIF. Get your request, contact info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And,
I'm sorry.
I'm a little bit embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 1-WRIF.
If you have acne, here's a phone number you need to call. 1-800-335-4191. Right now, we're looking for the biggest skeptics out there to test out a skin-clearing breakthrough risk-free. People who are sick and tired of wasting money on acne products that just don't work. If that's you, give us a call. We're going to prove you can make your acne disappear and have clear skin by sending you a 60-day trial of Proactive Solution absolutely risk-free with our compliments. Find out how to get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling 1-800-335-4191. Our combination therapy system uses prescription-grade acne medicine and soothing spa-quality botanicals to create a powerful acne fight. System. It's so effective, it transforms blemishes and bumps into clear, smooth skin, and skeptics into believers. You can have beautiful, healthy-looking skin. Put us to the test, and we'll prove it. Get your risk-free 60-day trial by calling now toll-free. 1-800-335-4191. 1-800-335-4191.
Imagine having the money for liposuction, a nose job, or tummy tuck. Well, now you can get the cosmetic procedure you want from an independent board-certified surgeon, all for less than you think. That's right. Independent board-certified surgeons managed by Doctors Say Yes are making cosmetic procedures affordable to everyone. Now you can afford the treatment you want with financing guaranteed, no matter what your credit looks like. If you've been thinking about becoming the perfect you, just call Doctors Say Yes at 1-866-495-8255. Their independent board-certified surgeons have assisted over 30,000 people, and they can help you afford the cosmetic procedure you've always wanted. Call Doctors Say Yes for your free consultation. Call 1-866-495-8189. Your call is confidential with no obligation. Call 1-866-495-8189. That's 1-866-495-8189.
You're faking it, and it's killing you. You go around wearing a smile, pretending everything's okay. You put up a front to disguise the fact that you're real sick with worry about your health, about your sanity, about everything, and you think nobody understands. But I understand. You're irritable, you lose sleep, and your mind is racing with fearful thoughts. You want to stop. You just don't know what to do. I'm Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center for Stress and Anxiety. I can show you how to make it stop. Please let me send you a powerful free tape that will help you discover a way to stop the painful anxiety and depression without abusing alcohol or taking medication. I did it, and so have hundreds of thousands of people just like you. Start changing your life from the inside out. Please call now.
Call now, and we'll send you this wonderful free tape. Call 800-449-7603. That's 1-800-449-7603. 1-800-449-7603.
101.1 WRIF, WRIF HD Detroit. Now, NutCall is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, as I'm sitting here at the station at this console about to do the interview, what's sitting in front of me? Some bad citizen left a Starbucks coffee container empty and didn't throw it away. But it brings us to our subject, and that's Starbucks, that ubiquitous coffee house that is seemingly everywhere. In many ways, Starbucks represents, sort of like other big corporations have at different times. Coca-Cola, for many generations, represented colonialism and imperialism. Nike, to many people, represented sweatshops in Asia. And people have very, very mixed views about Starbucks, rather because it's a very mixed phenomenon. Well, someone who took a grand look at is Kim Fellner. And Kim Fellner has devoted a working life to progressive activism. She's currently the development director for Working America. That's an innovative worker formation for those who do not have union representation on the job. Her past work includes 17 years in the labor movement as an organizer for the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, information director for the Screen Actors Guild, and the executive director of the National Writers Union. She's also the founding director of the National Organizers Alliance, and she's at her office in Washington, D.C. Kim Fellner, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to join you.
You've been busy.
I have been. It's been a busy year for all of us, and I might say a good one.
Well, wrestling Starbucks, I would suspect that grande numbers of the people that go into Starbucks don't do any wrestling whatsoever. It's a nice place to go. The coffee is terrific. It's got like a caffeine content twice of what you get in the local diners. And I don't know if I said the name of the book. It's Wrestling Starbucks, Conscience, Capital, and Cappuccino. And, well, let's go with it. Why are we wrestling with Starbucks?
Well, I think the fascinating thing about Starbucks, of course, is that it's big. It's everywhere. You know, one of the things I realized doing the research for this book is it was easy. Everyone I asked, they said, what do you think about Starbucks? And immediately you would get a story. I think it is that much a part of the culture. This book actually uses Starbucks as a lens to explore how we define and practice our values in the global economy. And it's interesting because Starbucks is so, you know, out there and many faceted. And so I approached it, you know, I didn't come at this because I thought, oh, Starbucks, great corporation. I actually came at it through my politics. I was in Seattle in 1999. As you remember, there was a big hoo-ha.
About the World Trade Organization. So I was going to say your interest in this began with a crash, didn't it?
It did. There I was standing really as part of a labor delegation surrounded by lots of auto workers and steel workers and Teamsters, and a labor demonstration goes through. I was a marshal for the labor crew. And the next thing that happens is some young demonstrators go by and smash in the Starbucks window, not 20 feet from where I'm standing.
Those anarchists.
Yes, well, you gotta love them. It's something about that scene struck me as kind of weird. You know, you have Starbucks, people think of it as a really good company. I myself wasn't averse to having a cup of Starbucks. And there were my fellow demonstrators smashing window, and I understood the symbolism of it, but I'm going, something doesn't seem quite right here.
Yeah, why would they break the window of a coffee house? That doesn't make a lot of sense on the face of it, and probably just seems like random destruction. It's not a tactic I think that either of us support as the way you get sympathy for the labor movement or the concerns that working people have, but there's obviously a lot of emotion there.
Yeah, you know, I think that the underpinnings for the whole demonstration about the World Trade Organization, which a lot of, you know, trade unionists and many of the rest of us in Main Street America understand, is that, you know, global corporations are really getting the upper hand, and workers, both here and abroad, are sort of bearing the brunt. And, you know, we've seen all of those things come to roost in the current economic meltdown. And for the demonstrators who smashed in the window of Starbucks, they were using that as a way to express their anger at all the big corporations whom they hold accountable for the ills and inequities of globalization. And I understood the symbolism of that, but I decided to sort of step out of my usual comfort zone and actually see whether there was what the real story was. What really was this company like? And in that exploration, I found out that it was a very complicated company with a lot of things recommended and some problems as well.
Well, let's explore those. My guest is Kim Fellner. The book is Wrestling with Starbucks, Conscience, Capital, and Cappuccino. And probably maybe of the three C's there, the least provocative is cappuccino. Why is that in the subtitle? Everyone, most people love the Starbucks cappuccino. Why does it wind up as part of the wrestling with the chain?
I think just for that reason, You know, we are a nation of coffee drinkers. We consume, a third of the world's coffee. And we tend to really crave it. And Starbucks has helped create a real market and interest in good coffee. So it's part of the equation. The second reason, of course, is that coffee, we tend to think of it as this cup that we have every day and that we love, but it's also the second most traded commodity in the world.
Is that right?
After oil.
Wow.
This is a really big, big business. And the other piece of the coffee industry, of course, is that coffee is produced in poor countries of the global south and largely consumed in more affluent countries.
A familiar pattern here.
It's a familiar pattern. And, there are 25 million small farmers who make their livelihoods almost exclusively from growing coffee, and way more people than that, 125 million, who owe their general livelihoods to it, whose incomes are dependent on the coffee chain. So that's very, very big business. It's large, and it affects a huge number of people.
That's amazing. I don't think many of us knew that. What seems odd about this, though, because it's much, much more decentralized and also much more labor-intensive, because when we think of oil, here are these companies, the firms that do the pumping and even the ones that own, like, say, chains of gas stations, they make billions and billions. Who's making all the money here?
Well, the interesting thing, of course, about all of this is that while Starbucks is big in gourmet coffee, and it's the face of coffee that we've grown to know, the truth of the matter is that Starbucks itself only buys about 5% of the world's coffee. The big barracudas in the world of coffee are familiar names, Nestle,
mm-hmm.
Procter & Gamble, Sara Lee, Kraft, all those are the really big coffee corporations. And they're also the ones that tend to pay the lowest prices and are the most abusive, both of the environment and of the workforce. Starbucks, really, when you take a closer look, is far better than that.
Well, when you look, though, at the activism around coffee, the boogeyman, bad guy in the eyes of many community activists, turns out to be Starbucks, not all these other companies that you mentioned. In fact, I should say, what do they call it, full disclosure, I'm currently drinking a cup of coffee as we talk. But how has Starbucks arisen as the bad guy in this equation?
Well, I think one of the reasons has to be that it's so visible. It's like Howard Schultz, who's the CEO of Starbucks, says, it's much easier to demonstrate in front of a Starbucks store and much more dramatic than it is to squish a can of Coke in your supermarket. And I think there is that. It is everywhere. It is an excellent target opportunity. And as demonstrators have also learned, pick at Starbucks and your place in the newspaper is pretty much assured. That being said, there's some reasons to hold Starbucks accountable for its behavior. This is a company that I tend to think of as kind of a shapeshifter, a cross-dresser. It's always fighting within itself about, balancing profit and principle. And so you have this company that wants to have global product reach, that wants to be the most recognized brand in the world, that has 17,000 outlets in 49 countries. At the same time, they're very internationalist in their vision. They are concerned about fairness to coffee growers. They have this image of an interconnected coffee culture. They're, in many ways, a very good employer. They were pioneers in offering part-time health coverage to their employees. They've offered domestic partner benefits. They do very good training. They, until the current breakdown in the economy as a whole, it did a lot of promotion within. Their workforce is very diverse. At the same time, they hate unions, and they say we're not We're not anti-union. We're pro-partner. And while they're the letter, their behavior has been fairly consistently anti-union.
The book is Wrestling with Starbucks, Conscience, Capital, and Cappuccino. My guest is Kim Fellner, who was a longtime labor organizer. CEO Howard Schultz, he has a rationale. And you spoke to him, right? Am I correct?
I spoke to him several times, and he is a very thoughtful and engaging person who truly has a commitment to doing good as well as doing well. But, you know, one of the things that we found is that there's sort of this host of liberal employers who think that what they do, if they are good employers, then a union really shouldn't be necessary. And as Howard Schultz wrote in his book and says, you know, he wanted Starbucks workers, I'm quoting him, to believe in their hearts that management trusted them and treated them with respect. I was convinced that under my leadership, employees would come to realize that I would listen to their concerns. If they had faith in me and in my motives, they wouldn't need union. So this is, sort of the benevolence of management.
Yeah, this is Daddy Warbucks or something like that.
Well,
Little Orphan Annie.
It's a problem.
Trust me.
We know from just looking at what's happened in Detroit and what's happened with the auto workers that no matter how benevolent the policy of Starbucks or a company like it may be, corporate management is not going to explicitly argue on behalf of worker concerns, particularly in the global economy. And so you have sort of this image, it used to be what's good for General Motors. So some of it's good for General Motors or for Starbucks might also benefit the employees. But as the current crisis in the auto industry makes it painfully clear, some of it makes life sustainable for workers, whether it's living wages or health benefits or safety regulations, can easily be sacrificed to a corporate bottom line.
Well, Kim Fellner, you've done so much work in organizing the labor movement over the years that when it gets right down to it, I mean, the employer may be the nicest man or woman in the world, have the best of intentions, but almost always they want to keep unions out because it costs them more money. They have to pay higher wages. They have to give better benefits. That's what the union movement has been about for the last 150 years, fighting that struggle. And mostly the cost war has been from the top down. It hasn't been enough from the bottom up, my estimation, but that's another question. But so you have nice guy, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, and it sounds pretty personalistic, trust me, but ultimately it's about no different than the most vicious anti-union company.
Well, I think there are some differences. That is, I do think that this is a company that actually does have some concern about principles, and I think that in their particular case, it isn't even so much money. The irony, of course, is that Starbucks does better than most corporate employers, gives better benefits than most corporate employers, is more thoughtful about many things. But what they share in common with other employers is that they like to retain the power. You know, it isn't just about profit in principle. The third P in there is power. And Starbucks, like most corporations, and I would have to add most organizations, likes to retain full power of its own decision-making.
Well, the CEO, all of a sudden his name's out of my mind, of Walmart said, we don't want anyone else's hand on the steering wheel.
You know, and that you bring up Walmart is actually really, I think, important for all of us to think about a little here, because actually the Starbucks model is distinctively different from the Walmart model. You know, Walmart has sort of made its mark. All those always low prices have meant, you know, pushing down wages for employees, all kinds of shenanigans to, you know, keep workers from their benefits, from their full pay. They've sort of pushed down the prices throughout their suppliers. You know, when Walmart comes in, Main Streets, your local hardware store, your local clothing store do go under. Starbucks actually took an alternate approach. They priced everything higher. They paid better wages. They gave better benefits. and they charged more for their product, not less. And so the impact that they have on communities is far and away better than the impact that Walmart tends to have. But I think what we also realize is that if we want Starbucks to keep its good practices, to be a good employer, we need to make sure that we organize the Walmarts and the McDonald's who drag down the retail and fast food sectors because they put corporate actors like Starbucks at a distinct advantage.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should remind people, too, I haven't in a while, that the book we're talking about is Wrestling with Starbucks, Conscience Capital and Cappuccino. The author is my guest on the Peter Werb Show, Kim Fellner. And there's a website for it, wrestlingwithstarbucks.com, wrestlingwithstarbucks.com. There'll also be a link on my site as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Now, the only organizing I know of, union organizing, at Starbucks is being carried out by the old industrial workers of the world, although they don't like to be called old industrial workers of the world. That's the IWW. You can go to IWW.org. And they're a radical union in many ways, and they have this incredible radical past. Are there more mainstream unions trying to organize Starbucks as well?
Well, there have been in the past. You know, I think that the IWW organizing effort is an interesting and problematic one. But the story that really gripped my heart in the unionizing efforts was at the roasting plant out in Kent, fairly close to Starbucks headquarters in Seattle. They tried to unionize over the years twice, and the management of the roasting plant there really badgered and hounded the folks who signed union cards. They organized a small unit within the plant and basically harassed all the people who had signed up until after a few years there were, you know, only two or three of the original folks left. And they told one of their employees, that they told their human relations staff, don't hire anybody who has a union experience. And one of the management people in the human relations department said, no, that's against the law. I'm not going to do that. And she was fired, and she eventually filed a charge with the Labor Relations Board, and the company settled for a large sum of money. I think that, you know, the thing with the labor struggles is it tells you something about the company, and we've already talked about, you know, like most other companies, Starbucks, it doesn't really think a union is necessary for its workers because they know better, but it also presents some challenges for the labor movement. And I think we in the labor movement have to think about how we do our organizing and where we set our priorities. To my mind, I think it's much more important to organize Walmart and McDonald's than to organize Starbucks, because I think that the damage that they do on our economic landscape is much greater. I do not think, you know, I think certainly any employees who want a union are entitled to have one.
And let the IWW go at it. They can. They seem to be willing to take on the struggle. Kim Fellner, there are very many union activists and progressive activists will not buy Coca-Cola for a number of reasons, including what's happened to union organizers at Coca-Cola plants in Colombia. Many won't buy Nike products because, as I said at the beginning of the show, they're emblematic of sweatshops. And some people call for a boycott of Starbucks on a number of different levels, including the way they've treated their union organizers in IWW. Do you suggest that? Do you think we should boycott Starbucks?
Well, I think, you know, consumer issues are everybody's choice. I am not a boycotter of Starbucks. I loathe the way they've handled their union issues and the way they treat unions. But I have some respect for the way they have treated farmers and their employees. And I have to say, you know, I do these talks all over the country, and every time I talk, there's some people in the audience, even here, you know, at the LCIO when I was talking about these issues, there are people there who actually have, you know, family members who've worked at Starbucks, and almost to a person, they have nothing but good things to say about the way they've been treated and about the opportunity that the company gave them. I think this is a very nuanced and difficult company for progressives to get a handle on. That's why it's wrestling with Starbucks.
I'm just getting up because we're actually almost at the end of our time with you, and people should grab the book. There's a lot more room for discussion of this and the nuances. In our neighborhood, there's an independent coffee house that has lots of meetings there, that has it's been a venue for when we've brought in singers and what have you. And if it comes down to a choice, Starbucks or an independent, is that an issue? It is an issue with me, actually.
But, in a choice, I'll always pick my local independent. But I think, again, it's sort of a mixed blessing. The truth is independents have done quite well, even in the Starbucks era. There are almost twice as many independents now as there were in the late 1990s. Starbucks has, in fact, increased the viability of independents, not the other way around, as our narrative goes. And I think that the other thing to think about is, I go to my local independents, the staff is almost always white. They get no benefits.
Non-union.
Yeah, they're non-union. The tip jar will say, give us tips so we can pay our health care, give us tips so Susie can go to the dentist. There's no avenue really to move up the ranks or to be promoted. And sometimes the coffee isn't even that great, and frequently they don't care who hoots about fair trade coffee. So, in fact, there are some things to be said, and I have a deep fondness for my local independent, and I patronize it. But we also know that often for the workforce and for, larger issues, people do better with bigger employers.
Wow. Well, maybe there's been a fourth C in the subtitle, Conscience Capital and Cappuccino, also complicated as well. The book is Wrestling with Starbucks, and it is published by Rutgers University Press. You can go to wrestlingwithstarbucks.com. There'll also be a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Kim Fellner, thanks for sharing the time with us.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
The home of WRIF.com. Get the latest rock news, concert links, and where Riff is rocking the streets. Check out Motor City's decent deals and get stuff for Hat Rise or your 101 The Riff. Online, anywhere in the world.
Website.
Websites worldwide. 101 WRIF and WRIF.com. Everything rocks.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-493-8159. Now you have qualified help in dealing with the IRS. This is the second chance you never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. Call right now for your second chance. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
If your credit card debt has gotten out of control, if you're over your head at monthly payments, here's one powerful secret the credit card companies don't want you to know. You have the right to settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, allowing you to cut your debt up to half or more. That's bad news for credit card companies, but it's great news for you. We're Consumer Debt Advocate, and we'd like to offer you a free consultation that will help you start eliminating credit card debt. For your free consultation that will set you free, call 1-800-984-6953. Don't ruin your credit by declaring bankruptcy. Settle your debt and move on with your life. During your free consultation, you'll find out what the credit card companies don't want you to know. For your free consultation that will help you settle your credit card debt for a fraction of what you owe, call today. The number is 1-800-984-6953. 1-800-984-6953.
Are the arteries in your home clogged? The damaging line kill from hard water is like blockage in your pipes. It affects your water pressure and costs you more than you realize in energy repairs and appliance replacement, as much as $1,200 a year. Now there's an easy solution to hard water problems that puts more flow in your system and avoids salts, chemicals, and magnetic oils. It's HydraCare. The patented kit sold worldwide. HydraCare is tested by energy utilities and is totally maintenance free. Just clip it onto your water pipe and HydraCare will break up and prevent line scale buildup in your appliance and throughout your plumbing system, guaranteed. Line scale buildup can mean higher energy costs. If your home has reduced water pressure, get those old pipes flowing again. Call HydraCare right now for free information. Call 1-888-889-6126 or log on to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 1-888-889-6126.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. Sports plays a pretty large role in lots of our lives. We're always rooting for the home team, what have you. But at different periods in our history, sports has taken on a magnified importance in the social and political life of our country. And one incident, one particular night long ago, still remains in the memory of many of us. And that's the Joe Louis-Max Schmeling fight in 1938. And I came here and asked somebody who I think was probably about 35, I said, I showed him this book, the author who we are going to interview, and in a minute, did he know about this? And sure he did. So let's welcome David Margalek. David Margalek has been on the broadcast before. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's worked there for the last 9 years. He covers culture and politics. He's in recently included profiles of Tony Blair, Ariel Sharon, and Robert Novak. And he also covered the trials of O.J. Simpson, Lorna Bobbitt, and William Kennedy Smith. The Times nominated him 4 times for the Pulitzer Prize. He was covering those trials for the New York Times. His brand new book is called Beyond Glory, Joe Louis versus Max Schmeling and A World on the Brink. David Margalek, welcome back to Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. It's very nice to be back.
And I should remind people when I say welcome back that your last book was Strange Fruit, a biography of a song, and that was the Billie Holiday song, the absolutely searing and, chilling song about lynchings in the South.
I seem to specialize in writing about 2 or 3 minute chunks of time. We had a 2 or 3 minute song and then a fight that lasted 2 minutes and 4 seconds.
That's interesting. I don't know if you saw the Bob Dylan biography on PBS last night. They had a little cut of Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit, and it actually brought me back to our conversation. But we should talk about Beyond Glory. It's an incredible book. There is a pattern, though. Late 30s, African Americans, how all of that intersects with the racial and larger politics of our country. What's the draw there for David Margalek?
Well, I think that there's something about that era that always interested me. It's an era when the civil rights movement was first starting to bubble up. It's an era of radical politics in America. It's an era of fascism in Europe. All of these mighty forces are going up against one another. And these things have always interested me. I mean, it was very recent history, I suppose, when I was growing up. But I was interested in it even then. I mean, I had heard the Edward R. Murrow recording. I can hear it now. I mean, Murrow is back in the news with this new movie, and there was a record that he made in the 50s with sounds of the 1930s, the Hindenburg blowing up and FDR's fireside chats, and it had a call of the Louis Schmeling fight on there. And so from a very early age, this fight has been part of my consciousness. I was always intrigued with it. I love the way that it framed issues as clearly and sort of crystal clearly as it did. And I was always intrigued with it. And I finally got around to writing a book about it.
Well,
and 7 years later, I finished.
Okay, I want to get into that a little while, why it took the length that it did. But remind people about the Joe Louis-Max Schmeling fight in 1938. All of us could use refreshing. That's why your book on glory is so interesting. But a thumbnail sketch of the fight and the kind of the social political milieu in which it occurred.
Well, the fight was in June of 1938. It pitted an African-American, Joe Louis, who was then the world's heavyweight champion, against Max Schmeling of Germany, a former world heavyweight champion. And, you know, strictly as a matter of boxing, it was an interesting event. But it really, it's gone extra significance because of the personalities and demographics, really, of the fighters. Lewis was an African-American, an icon in the community, a colossally important figure and much neglected figure, I think, in the history of civil rights in this country. A hero in black America, a hero in white America, really the first black man that white Americans were really cheered on. And that was all on one side. And then on the other side was Max Schmeling, a German, not a member, not a Nazi, but very much embraced by the Nazis and somebody who embraced the Nazis back to a considerable degree on the other side. And so it was not just Lewis against Schmeling. It was seen as white against black and freedom against fascism. Black America was very interested in it. Boxing at that point, of course, was really an enormously important sport, second only to baseball, and a heavyweight championship fight was really the biggest event in all of sports. And boxing framed ethnic, racial, political tensions in a way that no other sport did. After all, it was really mano a mano, is one man against another one in the ring, and boxing was a sport that had fierce ethnic rivalries built into it. I mean, there were Jewish boxers, black boxers, Irish boxers, European boxers, and it was just the kind of thing that lent itself to this sort of struggle. You know, this extracurricular struggle with extra factors beyond sport. And that's really, that interested me as much as the boxing element, really. This is a book about the 1930s and about the politics of the 1930s, really, as much as it is of sport. And I should just mention one more thing, Peter, which is that it was a rematch. Lewis, in 1936, was seen as the champion in waiting. He had revitalized boxing, as people in Detroit certainly remember. Lewis came along and electrified boxing. Boxing was sort of in the dumps. It was short on charismatic champions, and then Lewis came along and revivified the sport to the extent that the color line, which existed in boxing and had existed ever since Jack Johnson had lost the title in 1915, people have vowed that because of Johnson's escapades, there would never be another black champion. But as I write in the book, avarice trumped prejudice.
yeah.
I mean, what happened really was that people, you know, however people felt about blacks and about black world heavyweight champion, Lewis was too good to keep down, and too many people were making money off of him to keep down. So Lewis was seen in 1936 as invincible, and then Schmeling comes along, a very methodical, careful boxer who had studied Lewis's technique intimately, and beat him. He was a 10-1 underdog, and it was just an enormous event in athletics and in the world, a catastrophe, really, in African America. The cause of great celebrating in Germany. Schmeling returns on the Hindenburg, meets with Hitler and Goebbels when he gets back, as well as with tumultuous, adoring crowds. And this just sort of revved up the political implications of a rematch.
Yeah. Now, the first fight, 1936, was that a title match as well?
It was not a title match because Jimmy Braddock, you know, who's since been recalled in Cinderella Man,
sure,
the champion. But basically, Lewis was seen, as I say, as the all-but-official champion, and he was just beating one former champion after another in order to get a shot at Braddock. And really, Schmeling, he had beaten Primo Canera, former champion, in 1935, and then later in 1935, he beat Max Baer, another former champion, and Schmeling was just one more sacrificial lamb on the way to the title.
Here I am at a Detroiter, and there's that Joe Lewis fist in downtown Detroit and everything, and I can't remember for the life of me who Joe Lewis won the title from.
He won the title from Jim Braddock.
Oh, he did?
He won the title from Jim. That's a very interesting story. You would think that because Schmeling beat Lewis, he would have gotten the shot at the title.
Sure.
But for two reasons, he didn't. The first was that Braddock knew that he was a laid-up champion. He knew he was going to lose, and he wanted to cash in. He wanted to have the biggest payday he could get. And though he signed to fight with Schmeling, he realized that Lewis was the one that was going to bring in the fannies and the seats.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was looking basically for an excuse to get out of his contract with Schmeling to fight. And they came up with a very handy one, because Schmeling at that point was already enough of a political lightning rod threats to boycott any Braddock-Schmeling fight. And Braddock and his manager said, well, you know, we can't fight if anti-Nazis and Jews are going to boycott us, because Jews were up to 50% of the fans at the average heavyweight championship fight. No one will come to this fight. And so he slithered out of the contract with Braddock, with Schmeling, and then Braddock fought Lewis, and Lewis won the title. But as Lewis said, I'm not going to be the real champion until I beat the only man who beat me, Max Schmeling. And that set up the rematch in 1938.
David Margalek is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. He's the author of Beyond Glory, Joe Lewis versus Max Schmeling, A World on the Brink. I want to get to the last part of that in just a little while. And by the way, I should mention that David Margalek will be in our town in Detroit at Borders Books. That's on Woodward in Birmingham on Friday, October 7th at 7 p.m. I'm going to try to get there as well. Now, just a little bit more history. You mentioned Jack Johnson, who outraged white America. He went out with white women. He opened up interracial clubs in Chicago. He went to Mexico and denounced the United States when he was indicted for some phony crime. There's always portrayal of Lewis was a good Negro. He didn't spit in the face of white America. He was essentially living like an ordinary mm-hmm. human being. But but you mentioned Lewis as sort of a precursor of the civil rights movement. Could you kind of
right?
Yeah.
Well, I think that in the sense that Lewis set out, Jack Johnson, incidentally, was very unpopular. He had made a lot of enemies in Black America too. You know, there were many people in Black America who weren't crazy about his carry on with white women. And so he was a very controversial champion. And Joe Lewis came along and set out with the help of his manager, John Roxborough of Detroit. He set out to be a very different kind of boxer, you know, somebody who behaved himself, who didn't flaunt his victories, who didn't hang out with white women, who was always very polite in the ring and out of the ring. And in so doing, he became acceptable not only in white America, but in Black America, too. I mean, everybody embraced him, but particularly in the way that white America embraced him. Well, actually, there are two prongs to it. He was a civil rights leader in the sense that white America embraced him in a way that had never embraced a Black athlete or a Black man before. And that in and of itself was a source of tremendous power for him and influence. And, I think that he raised the racial consciousness of a whole generation of white people.
Yeah.
I think that's not an overstatement. And then he was a source of really colossal racial pride in the African-American community. I mean, if you go back and read the Black newspapers from that day, they covered him from stem to stern, his every activity, his marriage to a young Black woman, you know, the way that he bought a house for his mother in the Black bottom section of Detroit. Every time he went out, spent a lot of money on clothes or whatever, it was a source of great race pride. And, I once wrote a story about all the songs that were written about Joe Lewis. I mean, you and I, if we thought about how many songs that were written for athletes, you know, a song about Joe DiMaggio, a couple songs about him, you know, and here and there you can think of one. By one count, there were 43 songs written about Joe Lewis. There was a whole CD of Joe Lewis songs that came out a few years ago. And so he was just a source of enormous racial pride. And I think in that sense, and also as a liaison to the white world and white America, his decency as a champion, his conduct during the war when he joined the army and rallied the troops, he's an enormous hero.
Now,
but a lot of fashion, I think was sort of supplanted in the public imagination by Ali. I think that's one of the reasons. I've often wondered, you know, why is this book, would it long to be written? I mean, after all, this fight, you know, was on everybody's list of the greatest athletic events of the 20th century. Why did it take so long for someone to write a book about it? And I think it was partly because Lewis seems like an old-fashioned figure now. But that's not really for us to say. I mean, the historian's role here is to write about what his contemporaries thought about him, and that's what I did.
Now, you had Joe Lewis, in a sense, or maybe in a larger sense, particularly Black Americans, but any white Americans as well, representing our country against this representative of this increasingly hostile Nazi government. Yet you had a situation in the United States during the 30s when there was a Great Depression, and, of course, people are always looking for scapegoats, and in terms of racial segregation, internal domestic terrorism is what kept African Americans for almost 100 years as second-class citizens. How did that all play out? So you had, I mean, on one hand, did you have this white people with this great amount of racism being exhibited, and then on the other hand, rooting for a Black fighter, which there was a Spike Lee film like that had those aspects to it. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, no, that's right. And this was an issue that Nazi press made a great thing out of. You know, they would talk about how, you know, a Black champion was fine for Americans when they were afraid of losing the heavyweight title, and Black athletes were fine when they wanted to win gold medals at the Berlin Olympics, but the rest of the time they treated Blacks abysmally, and what a hypocrite they were. And it's an interesting thing. It was all over the Nazi press. Of course, the Nazi press would go on to say that the black man was inferior. And what offended them about American racial attitudes was not prejudice, but hypocrisy. They pretended to be better than they really were. And so it's very true that Lewis, you know, Lewis's career was against this terrible racial backdrop. And there are plenty of instances where Lewis felt the sting of racism himself. I mean, if you read the contemporary newspaper article about him, you know, there are all kinds of racial stereotypes in them. You know, I remember the lead of the Washington Post article on the fight, on the second fight, the 1938 fight, is, you know, Joe Lewis, the lethargic chicken-eating colored boy, beat Max Schmeling last night. Yeah. The lead in the Washington Post. But at the same time, I'm very wary of feeling self-righteous and, you know, feeling sort of historically self-righteous about these things and assuming that people back then were all ignoramuses. We're all so enlightened. And, you know, at the same time back then, there were surprising statements from many, many white writers about how Lewis was a proud man and extolling him and exhibiting a great deal of racial tolerance. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't all clear back then. I mean, there were a whole bunch of, you know, a wide range of racial attitudes.
David Margulick is my guest. Remember, he's going to be in Detroit Friday, October 7th, 7 p.m. at the Borders Books in Birmingham. The book is Beyond Glory, Joe Lewis and Max Schmeling and A World on the Brink. It's published by Knopf.
I wish, just if I can interrupt you, Peter, just to say that I wish I'd been on your show 3 years ago or 4 years ago, because I would have loved to have heard the memories of people in Detroit of Joe Lewis. You know, Joe Lewis started in Detroit. Sure. He was born in Alabama, but he emigrated to Detroit with his family as a young boy, and came up the hard way in Detroit and began boxing in Detroit. And it's something that Detroit can be very proud of. And I once went to the Joe Lewis Museum over at Cobo and talked to some people who remembered Lewis who were over there, gathered over there for a commemoration of Lewis. But it would have been very interesting to have spoken to people who watched him and watched him progress and make his way. I also would have liked to have known more about Paradise Alley and Black Bottom and the very vibrant black neighborhood in Detroit. You know, there's a lot of the book about celebrations there, you know, after Lewis fights. The Lewis fights were always huge events in the black community, and there were celebrations after all of his most notable victories. After he won in 1938, there were 500,000 people on the streets of Harlem celebrating. But there were also victories and victory celebrations in Detroit. Even had the, you know, the street names Beaubien Street and the various other streets, Verner Avenue. And I think somebody told me that I'm not an authority, even though I went to school in Ann Arbor, I'm not an authority on Detroit, but somebody told me the highway just went right through there, the interstate highway, and cleared it all out and really destroyed what was once a very vital neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I would have liked to have known more about that.
There was this, stretching out of Black Bottom, which was near downtown Detroit, and then there was this whole major thoroughfare called Hastings.
Hastings,
and,
yeah.
And the I-75 highway, just the interstate, just obliterated that incredible piece of Detroit history.
There was this, one of the famous stories, you know, when they were very conscious of Joe Lewis's image, and one of the famous stories was that after he started to make some money, one of the first things they did was bought his mother a house in Detroit, in Black Bottom. I think it was on Hastings Street. I have the addresses in my book. I think he paid $9,500 for it. And the black press would chronicle very lovingly how much money he spent for furniture. And, you know, and his mother was saying, we don't want a great show-off house. We just want a decent house.
That's extraordinary, you know. sum, though, for those years.
It was an extraordinary sum for back then. And I think somebody told me that, you know, the city ended up paying a pittance for the house, and they just, you know, it was all cleared out when I-75 went through.
I'm sure. David Margulick, before we, in fact, this is why your book, Beyond Glory, about the Lewis Schmeling fight, has so many pages in it, but we haven't really even gotten to the fight. A lot of people probably do remember there are documentaries about the fight, but tell us about the fight, and perhaps so we talk about some other things in less time than the fight took, which is probably kind of easy.
Yeah, well, the fight was really, you know, it's a famous story about Count Basie coming into the fight and sitting down and dropping his hat, and he bent over to pick it up, and by the time he came back up again, the fight was over.
Yeah, it was.
You know, I mean, Lewis came out of his corner. Usually, you know, they would spar around for a round or two and just sort of feel one another out. And in this instance, Lewis was fired up that night. Lewis didn't like Schmeling. Lewis was there's this great myth that they were great buddies and became great buddies. It's something that I one of many myths surrounding the story that I've tried to explode in the book. Lewis was an angry man the night of that fight. He felt that Schmeling had made racist statements. He felt that Schmeling had ripped him off on fake films. And he felt that Schmeling had charged him unfairly with deliberately fouling him the first fight. And he felt Schmeling was a bad sport. And so he came tearing out of the corner that night and quickly got Schmeling on the ropes and pummeled him really into submission. Punched him in the kidney, a perfectly legal punch, and some sprawling and breaking a couple of his vertebrae. Schmeling was in the hospital for 10 days afterward. And it was just, many people think it was the greatest exhibition of boxing history, and certainly it was the most electrifying 124 seconds in the history of boxing.
And then, as you indicated just in passing before, these enormous demonstrations broke out in the black community, all across the United States.
In black neighborhoods all across the country, mostly good-natured, but in some places violent. There was a woman killed in Gary, Indiana. There was a black boy killed in Cleveland. You know, people overturning trolley cars, taunting whites. But, you know, all across the country and indeed beyond, you know, in black neighborhoods everywhere in the Caribbean, in Africa, everybody was following the fight. I mean, it's the kind of, it had the kinds of numbers you would envy. I think that 100 million people listened to the fight.
Really?
And
that on radio.
By my calculation, I mean, you know, one is very reluctant to say the most or the biggest, but by my calculation, the largest radio audience in history, and far larger, for instance, than the radio audience that heard Seabiscuit. This was boxing, after all. These were people involved. This was a mammoth event, and the world really stopped for it.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and I don't think we're ever going to get to the world on the brink. That's World War II. But Berlin, how did Hitler and Goebbels take this loss?
Well, of course, they had built up Schmeling. They had always assumed that even though Lewis was younger and stronger, that Schmeling was smarter and better person. You know, the whole Nazi mythology was that if you had the determination and the will and the character, you could overcome anything. And they thought that Schmeling would win just on that. And so, of course, another myth is that when the fight was broadcast back to Germany, and the myth was that they cut the broadcast in the middle when Schmeling went down. This is not true. The entire fight was broadcast. Another myth is that when Schmeling went back afterwards, he became a non-person. That also is not true. I mean, it's clear that it was a crushing blow to them, but they very quickly realized that they couldn't run away from it, and they just sort of dampened down the coverage. The coverage afterwards was very subdued. But Schmeling remained a visible figure in Germany afterwards, still going to Nazi rallies and stuff like this, even though he never joined the party. And I write in the book that he gets credit for never joining the party, but in fact, to do business in America in the 1930s, and particularly in largely Jewish New York, it would have been pretty suicidal to have any affiliation with the Nazis any more than he already had. So, when you know, he shouldn't be given too much credit for distancing himself from the Nazis. It would have been professionally suicidal.
Well, we only scratched the surface in this long interview with David Margalek, and that's why he's written the book. It's absolutely incredible. Great photographs as well. Beyond Glory is the name of it. Joel Lewis versus Max Schmeling and a World on the Brink. Remember that David Margalek will be in Detroit Friday, October 7th at Borders Books in Birmingham. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Red Talk on 101 WRIF Detroit. Back to the Rock.
101 WRIF.
The Riff.
HD1.
101 WRIF.
And WRIF. HD1 Detroit.
Everything relaxed.